Happy Friday, everyone. You're listening to Radio DePaul Chicago's College Connection. This is PopCast Season 5, Episode 6, 7, 7. This is the show where we review, discuss, and gush over all things pop culture, more specifically movies and television, sometimes video games and comic books. I'm your host, Matthew Barbuccio, and for the last time, to my right, my lovely co-host, Reed Lubin, and to my left, my other lovely co-host, Daniel Torres. How are you guys doing?
Beautiful.
For the last time at Radio DePaul.
At Radio DePaul.
Yes.
Yeah, this is the
last time forever.
Also, last time I'm
not good with change, yeah. Everybody. Just a heads up.
Reed is... No, that is not even a joke.
Yeah. I'm a wreck.
Reed has handcuffed himself to the studio.
Yeah. And
I ain't leaving.
This week's show is
Reed is going to pull a Money Monster in here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I just... somebody brought up Money Monster to me yesterday.
We
got
to stop. We got to stop bringing up Money Monster.
Yeah, it's actually
it
unhealthy.
It needs to go away.
It's unhealthy. Tasha Robinson liked that movie. Who's a very respected critic, yeah. And I love her. I love almost everything she does.
She also kind of
liked that movie.
She kind of gave Suicide Squad a pass.
Did she really?
Sort of.
Yeah, she said in her tweet, she said, I didn't hate it as much as everybody else.
Oh,
so that's basically saying she loved it.
Yeah, loved it.
I mean, she basically, that's her favorite movie of all time.
Going back to Money Monster, though, it's surprising. I think that movie ended up like around a 50, hovering around 50 to 60% on Rotten Tomatoes. I think around, closer to 60, actually. So a fair amount of people somehow liked that movie.
Wow. Yeah. Well, we didn't. We sure didn't.
Yeah, no.
Well, this week on the show, we have news. We're going to be reviewing Hell or High Water by David McKenzie. We're also going to be reviewing Pete's Dragon, the new Disney...
Did you just decide that just now?
Well,
I didn't know that. No, I'm down. I had no idea
because
we were doing that.
We already talked about this.
Daniel, you're going to be in the dark because you haven't seen Pete's Dragon.
Yeah. Reed and I have seen Pete's Dragon. Daniel has
and
not.
And we're going to spoil
but
Pete's Dragon.
We all have seen Hell or High Water.
I will lead the discussion on Pete's Dragon.
Do what you got to do.
I don't think... I mean, you know, I didn't love Pete's Dragon, but I think... These are two really good films to go out on.
And they came out the same weekend in August.
And much better than War Dogs.
Much better than War Dogs. We did not want to watch
it. We have not seen War Dogs, so do not judge War Dogs.
Well, they're better prospects than War Dogs. Like, if I would have picked these movies over War Dogs even if I hadn't seen
them. They have higher upsides.
One better discussion.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
so let's get to the news.
I want to discuss War Dogs.
Last news segment here at Radio DePaul.
No,
Chicago's College Connection.
Last news segment. There was a lot of stuff that dropped this week, more specifically in the latter half of the week. Let's start off with a big trailer that teased us last week. So we had a teaser trailer for this film. The film is called Arrival. It is directed by Denis Villeneuve, and it stars a lot of people you might know. Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, Michael Stuhlbarg, Forest Whitaker. And it basically takes place on Earth sometime in modern day, a little bit in the near
future.
In the near future, where alien ships land all across planet Earth. And I know where you think this is going, right? Oh, is this Independence Day? No, it looks like a little bit more toned down than that. Amy Adams plays an interpreter who is sent to try to communicate with these aliens to figure out why they're here. And it's got elements of a lot of films that we've seen, like maybe some District 9, Close Encounters of a Third Kind, the Jodie Foster movie that I can't remember the name of, where she... What's it called? Contact? Where Jodie Foster
Contact.
Is like... Is
yeah,
that what it's called? Contact? So,
Robert Zemeckis.
Yeah, so it has a lot of elements of some other films, but it's directed by Denis Villeneuve, who's coming off... He's really on a hot streak right now. He had Prisoners in 2013. Just last year, he had one of our favorite films of the year, I think, collectively, Sicario.
And also Enemy.
Enemy
a few years back.
And it's an Enemy more like sci-fi-ish.
Well, it's more of a thriller.
Supernatural.
Okay.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that film.
And this,
really? It's awesome.
So this is his highest budgeted film. It looks, I think the budget is closer to $100 million than any of his other films have been. And he, in my opinion, is a fantastic director, and I've been very much looking forward to this movie, which for a long time was titled Story of Your Life, because it's based on a short story titled Story of Your Life. So I'm glad they changed that title, because that's pretty weak.
That sounds like a romantic, you know.
Exactly.
Nicholas Sparks thing.
That does my thoughts exactly. So now, after seeing the teaser last week, the full length trailer was dropped this week. We got a chance to check it out. Matt, let's start with you. What are your impressions?
I was not blown away by this trailer. I thought it was pretty generic. It looked as if, I mean, it looks incredible, but just take the framing out of it and take how beautiful it looks and take all that stripped away.
Well, take out the fact that we know it's Denis Villeneuve directing it.
Strip that away, I wouldn't be excited for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, if this was like the guy who did like Tron, I'd probably be like, eh, whatever. But
or the guy that did Oblivion.
Yeah, same person.
Are they really?
Yeah, yeah.
That's actually hilarious.
Yeah.
That is hilarious.
Who did Tron? I'm looking up his
Joseph
name right
now. The guy that did Oblivion.
Kaczynski, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, in some ways, like I said this to Matt, but it kind of looks like it looks a little bit like Midnight Special in terms of just like, you know, an established kind of like more independent leaning director kind of doing this take on like traditional sci-fi and trying to make it, trying to deepen it or make it, you know, more, I guess, serious for lack of a better word. And I'm interested. I mean, I think the trailer, I mean, same thing with Midnight Special, even though like I didn't really end up loving or liking that movie as much as others, but that movie kind of had a similarly kind of bland and awkward trailer, I think. And I think yeah, it's just because they have to find a way to market this to people. So I'm willing to give this like trailer benefit of the doubt for being kind of bland looking.
By the way, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
What are our thoughts on Midnight Special?
Well, I was just about to. I like the movie.
Like we've had a lot of
it's been
time.
Months, and yeah. we were all looking forward to it very much.
I'm liking it more and more.
That's funny.
You know what's funny is that I was liking it less and less, and then over the last month, I was like, but it was still good.
I still think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I do too. Oh, yeah. Well, the ending kind of sucked. I do realize
I love
that now.
That ending.
And me and Reed had this discussion last night.
Yeah, we were on the train last night, and
I cried at the ending. I really,
really?
Did. Yeah, I wow. teared up.
And you didn't cry at Peace Dragon? You monster.
I did cry at Peace Dragon. Good. It's kind of hard
he
not
to. He also yeah, cried at the end of Everybody Wants Them.
No, I didn't. Yeah, I did.
I teared up during the baseball scene. Because there's never been a better baseball scene on
Reed screen. Teared up at the Suicide Squad trailer, so they literally
I might have a problem, everybody.
It literally means nothing.
Tears mean nothing yeah. to me. Yeah, but my thoughts on this trailer, I never thought of that, but I love that comparison to Midnight Special in the sense where this is a director that's typically done smaller films, but you know, still with a larger cast, and this is his chance where a studio's given him a lot of money. And what I love about this trailer is it's still relatively ambiguous. Like it's kinda like the Midnight.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
I love that because I mean, it might be a problem for in terms of marketing and how much money this movie's going to make coming out in November 11th, I believe, around the time of Doctor Strange and Fantastic Beasts and Passengers with Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence. This thing's going to have a lot of competition.
That needs a trailer, by the way.
It's going to come out, my guess, any day. Probably today.
But it's,
I mean, literally.
It is interesting because I do think Villeneuve, his aesthetic and just his style is more mainstream leaning than Nichols or...
I agree with that.
I can see, or not even in a qualitative sense in terms of just like which one is better and which one is like
or just
lesser.
Which one is more receptive to audiences.
No, yeah, but I think he has a better chance of like crossing that divide. And actually, this is actually kind of an interesting narrative because we've seen, you know, how many of these indie directors get, you know, thrown into the whole superhero thing. And maybe, you know, Denis Villeneuve can be that guy who can straddle that line where he's getting these projects that aren't necessarily $200 million, but yeah. they're big budgets, and he's still able to make movies that he wants to.
Well, his last two movies, Sicario, made a lot of money for its budget.
No, especially
yeah, 85.
Sicario
Prisoners
was
made
surprisingly 80, successful.
It was $85 yeah. million on a $30 million budget, so it's a success, and obviously the greenlit the sequel. But Prisoners made over $120 million. So, yeah. I mean, his movies... Even though, like, the lesser, you know, the ones intended for maybe smaller audiences still find an audience.
Well, Prisoners was actually, like, I mean, yeah, that was a mainstream film.
What are our thoughts on Prisoners?
Oh, I like Prisoners.
I was actually not a fan.
Yeah, a lot of people don't like that movie.
So I was not a fan, so I went into Sicario because the trailer looked so great to me. I was like, okay, this is going to be good, and I ended up loving it, so now I'm, you know, right back. And I really liked Enemy, so I'm right back on the train.
I have Prisoners on Blu-ray just because that movie was the best-looking movie of that year.
Oh, it was gorgeous. I'd like to watch it again at your house, yeah. in your basement.
Yeah.
Lights off.
I don't love that movie.
Candle lit.
And I can understand because I
birthday
do think
cake.
There's something that is, like, a little... exploitative about that film and sensationalized about it. But it is like I think in terms of just like how it's constructed, it's a good film, and I think I love Jake Gyllenhaal in that film.
He's very interesting.
He's the best part
film.
Of that
yeah,
film.
He's
Detective Loki. That's his name.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great performance. Really interesting character, also a character that you don't usually see.
Yeah.
But actually, my thoughts on this Arrival trailer because I think we kind of went away from that.
Yeah.
Like you said, Matt, this trailer doesn't give us too much. But because my anticipation level before I even saw the teaser trailer, because I knew what the story was about, I mean, this has been one of my most anticipated of the year. And I think it looks like visually, it looks beautiful. And
yeah, looks
we
cool.
got kind of what the story's about. We know that there's going to be elements, or at least what I believe is there's going to be elements of, you know, peace versus war, where Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner's characters, I believe, the translators are going to want to communicate. And then they're going to be the big bad Americans or other governments that are going to want to shoot these aliens down. And obviously there's going to be a struggle there. Who knows? There could be something completely different. I think it's an intriguing story. The talent behind it alone, you know, like you said, if it was the director of Tron, or if it was if it was Peter Berg, I'd have my doubts. But because
Peter Berg only makes political movies,
yeah. so if this was in different hands, maybe this trailer would do less for me because it's
Peter
not.
Peter Berg will soon be employed by Breitbart. So
oh god, but no, but I mean this trailer, if it was done by other people, I might not be as receptive to it. But because of how because of the talent involved and because of kind of the ambiguity of the trailer, I think it looks gorgeous. I'm still very much looking forward to Arrival.
And I'm actually really curious just to see, like, his interviews once the movie comes out, because there were so many interviews about Midnight Special where Nichols is kind of talking about it. And it is interesting that it seems like Close Encounters was such an influential movie to that generation, and we're starting to see all these directors that are kind of making these movies that feel like, you know, referencing and homages to that film.
Yeah.
Even something like Stranger Things in some ways, even though that's more like a mix of just 80s genre films. Yeah.
I'm wondering, I always wonder, I love looking at big picture stuff. I'm wondering what film will be our generation's, or yeah, like our group of filmmakers.
Yeah, I wonder if The Dark Knight is going to be there.
What's that film? Or Mad Max, or what are the films? What are the ones that are going to be the Close Encounters, the ones that we see 20 years from now being replicated?
Batman versus Superman.
Invoked. I don't even really know. It's an interesting conversation.
In that genre, I think that genre has been kind of played out, you know, in terms of like, you know.
But it's been so long.
It has been. So maybe Arrival.
I don't think it ever dies.
So like, maybe. No, I don't think it dies, but I think genres evolve, though.
But it's like the same thing with like the Western, where it's just like, I mean, Hell or High Water, when we get to it, I mean, that is like an explicit Western, but something like Mad Max, like, that's so much riffing on the Western genre, too, that even if, you know, the sci-fi elements get, you know, conflated into another genre, like, the influence still kind of exists.
Next story.
Let's stay on the Denis Villeneuve train, because we've got another story involving him, to a lesser degree. He is directing the upcoming and very much looked forward to by some, I think a lot, the upcoming Blade Runner sequel. How many years later? Do we remember when the first
Blade Runner? The first one is 87,
84,
right?
I think.
Let me look it up.
I think it's early.
So around 30 years ago was when Blade Runner came out, and the cast for his upcoming sequel,
82.
Wow. So math would mean 30 something, 5
34.
Years, 44 years. I'm good at math, guys. The cast up until yesterday was incredibly stacked, starting with Ryan Gosling, Ana de Armas, Robin Wright, Harrison Ford, Mackenzie Davis,
and everyone's favorite
Barkhad Abdi, and Dave Bautista, who kind of made his name known in wrestling, but then in Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, as of yesterday, one more cast member has been added, and he's people's favorite, the Joker himself, Jared Leto. Jared Leto is joining the film in an undisclosed role, but it is believed to be a key role, and I would imagine you hire someone like Jared Leto, you're not going to hire him for a quick cameo like they did for Suicide Squad, which he was basically a cameo. So
apparently he didn't know he was going to be a cameo.
Yeah, of course
either.
Not. He wouldn't have gone.
Have you heard those interviews?
He wouldn't have gone full method.
Oh my God. He's
going against WB.
He is like really lashing back at Warner Brothers because he's like, and same with Margot Robbie.
He said he was tricked into it.
In a more polite fashion, Margot Robbie, but they're like, we shot like a full movie of Joker and Harley Quinn stuff, and it's not in the movie. And he was saying in interviews, like, yeah, I wish I was in the movie more as well. Like, I'm on the same page with you. Like, I don't know.
And then he said FDC. They asked what he thought. He said F them.
It's gonna really be funny. If there's a video. You can hire a new Joker.
Well, that's the talk. They're gonna replace. There's been a lot of talk that they're gonna replace the Joker. But what's interesting now is this Blade Runner sequel is Warner Brothers. So I mean, you know, if he's joining this, maybe his relationship with Warner Brothers isn't as bad as
we're all speculating. Warner Brothers is a huge company,
right? There are other
different producers attached.
Yeah, I don't think Zack Snyder has anything to do with this Blade Runner sequel.
Or Kevin Sugihara, maybe.
He might. I think Kevin Sugihara definitely does have a thing to do with. However,
he wants to incorporate elements of Pan into Blade Runner.
Well, that'd be a good idea. Jared Leto joining Blade Runner. Matt, let's start with. Or no, let's Daniel. We'll start with you because we started with Matt last time. Daniel, your thoughts on this?
I can't stand him personally, but I mean, he's not a terrible actor, so I mean, sure, why not?
You don't got more to say than that?
Well, I don't. I just feel like there's
he's a good actor.
I feel like there's not much more to say other than that. I hate him. I don't like him. I think he's human garbage, but
that is so personal.
Daniel knows Leto.
No, I know. It's like
he owes him money.
The way you criticize Leto is so unfair.
Like, How about Eddie Redmayne?
No,
that's a joke. That is like
right.
Like, Eddie Redmayne's probably a great guy.
He seems like a great guy.
But like, I mean, the whole like. I mean, I just can't stand this whole, like, his whole obsession with, like, this stupid bro sense of method acting that is completely false.
Your anger is so misplaced, and I'm not saying that it's wrong to, like, dislike him, but the way you hate him is so personal, and it's not feasible for you to have those feelings without knowing the person. I'm just saying, like, it is literally, like, it is just irresponsible to be that.
Daniel, Matt is saying you need to get help. That's what Matt is saying.
No, but I'm sorry. No, those antics, they're inexcusable, and, like, I'm sorry, like, that's not acceptable, and, like, that deserves to be called out. And to be fair, like, he has been being called out on him, but, like, I don't like him.
Nah, stop. I mean, he's being called out. People hate him. Like, the tide is officially turned on Jared Leto, for better or for worse, like, if you're a fan or not.
I know. I'm just saying we don't know him.
No, I agree with that 100%. I agree. I'm actually in with Matt. Like, do I think he's a good person? Probably not. Do I think he's a little dim and maybe he's just tone deaf? I think that's a big part of it, because I don't think he's intending to be as big a D-bag as he's turning out to be.
There's a recklessness to that.
And absolutely. And that the Joker has. The recklessness.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's just, I don't know, you're right. I mean, I don't know him personally, but I just find him annoying. And it's just
At this point, can you just pretend that you know him so this makes a little bit more sense?
Yeah, I met him in L.A.
But no, you're right. Aside from his antics on the Suicide Squad, and like all the articles coming out, like, nobody was like, people were probably annoyed, but all the articles of like, I would have punched him, and like, that guy was such an a-hole, like, those were false reports. Like, nobody was like legitimately disturbed by what he was doing.
Well, I think people
I'm disturbed by what he was doing.
I do want to set one thing, and I don't even like to mention it on air because it's such a gross thing, but there were rumors that he sent a used something. I'm not going to say what it was. You can say it if you want. But he sent a used something to another actor on set, and I believe that has been proved false. Like, that was proven false. Like, that never
happened. That's what I'm saying. I'm thinking all of these
other
like,
things did happen. Like, he did send
a dead pig or whatever.
Or a dead pig's face or something like that. And that's creepy and gross.
And he sent bullets.
Yeah, he was just being so weird and like.
Yeah, but that's not like that's.
No, it's freaking strange. But you know, it's not the end of the world.
But he can get away with that because of who he is. And frankly, like, I mean, another thing that needs to be, I think, addressed here, and it's probably a little unfair to Jared Leto in the sense that David Ayer should be getting so much more crap for this in terms of just, like, you're the director of this film. You set, like, the working conditions that happened here, and, like, I mean, besides, like, the Jared Leto...
For Fury, they had fist fights, you know, in between sets, like, literally, like,
no, yeah, and I'm sorry, like, so. I just think that type of just, like, dumb, pointless hyper-masculinity that isn't even anything, like, it's not even adding anything interesting into the film is stupid, and, like, I think it should be called out, and, like, I don't really like, is he a terrible actor? No, you're right. Like, and he definitely, like...
Can you say, I don't know if this is possible for you to say, can you admit that he's at least a good actor?
Yeah, I mean, he's a good actor. I don't think he, I mean...
I'm not,
overrated.
I think he's a very good actor. I think he's shown in more than Dallas Buyers Club. I mean, his role in Panic Room is really fun for as creepy as, like, he plays a... That's a real creep, that guy that he played in Panic Room. See him kind of hone that in a little bit.
He's not a terrible actor, but to a certain extent,
and he's never,
like,
shown these tendencies before Suicide Squad. Like, there had been no reports that Jared Leto had been a...
People had noticed that he was kind of tone-deaf, and he says weird stuff in speeches and on interviews and on Twitter especially.
But that's not
entirely
true.
He was basically harmless.
There's stuff on Dallas Buyers Club, too, in terms of just, like, how much he kind of...
He was very method, yes. He was method on Suicide Squad.
But I'm just tired of that. Like, what you're doing, like... I mean, sure, every actor has their own techniques and whatever, but, like, you're just using this label as method just to do, like, these really stupid, and you're right, mostly tone-deaf things, but they're still stupid, and they deserve to be called out, and, like, I'm not going to give him benefit of the doubt for that. Like,
and it just becomes kind of... It just becomes kind of sad when you realize that he did all of that for 5 minutes in Suicide Squad. I feel bad for him. Like, that's kind of...
I kind of feel bad for him.
All right, Matt, let's actually get your opinion on him joining Blade Runner.
Well, he's definitely going to be a replicant. He will be playing...
That's what a lot of people think,
He will be playing the role opposite Ryan Gosling. I think those guys can have some weird adversarial chemistry.
Well, you know, it's funny, WB went to Ryan Gosling to play the Joker before Jared Leto.
I don't like that idea at all, actually.
For who?
For Gosling.
Yeah, I'm glad he kind of steered clear of that.
But Ryan Gosling continues... I mean, Jared Leto, I'm excited for him to be in the movie because I think he gives really interesting performances.
And with Villeneuve, it's like, this is a director that's not going to yell violence and take out a real gun and point in your face. Go act! You know, put it to your head. Like, he's going to tell Jared Leto...
Punch Shia LaBeouf in the face!
Yeah, it's like everyone that was freaking out. I mean, on Facebook, I'm in this cool group called The Dissolve that Daniel invited me to, and they were a former film group website. All really smart and intelligent people. But some of the overreactions I was seeing about how now they're no longer interested in this movie, it's like... Because the one actor who's actually a good actor, and, like, you don't think Villeneuve knows what he's doing in casting? Have you seen his other movies? Like, cut this guy.
No, but I think there's a certain truth where it's just like...
It's just this hyperbole that kind of bothers me.
No, I mean, there's hyperbole, but...
It is internet BS.
Yeah, it's a little...
No, but people deserve to be held accountable for things. And, like, I mean, I think we can... we can argue about what he did, whether it is that bad or not, but like I think it's totally fair. Like people should be calling stuff out. Like
I agree that they should be calling it out, but what I think is BS is the I'm no longer looking for it. You were never looking forward to Blade Runner 2 if you're all of a sudden saying that I'm no longer.
And I bet all those guys watch Cafe Society. Like I'll bet.
Oh yeah, that's a great point. And they watch other movies from people that have been arrested for things or have done horrible things that haven't been convicted. Yeah. Like people, like don't. Why is this the one? I mean, like that everyone's dying. What is this? Why is Leto the hill that everyone's dying?
It's because it's harmless. It's easy to. It's easy to make fun of him.
Yeah.
And he's just like, he takes himself so seriously, and it's not that serious of a
crime. Exactly.
You know, it's easy to talk about. People. You know, when they get into that murkier stuff and the more diabolical stuff, the Woody Allen's, the
Polanski's.
X-Men.
Bryan Singer
stuff.
Yeah.
Then they don't feel comfortable talking about it. They don't feel comfortable, you know, exclaiming their opinion on the internet. But if it's just some harmless actor.
No, but the tide has changed a lot on Woody Allen.
What, back to going to see his movies?
Because
movies just got nominated for an Oscar.
No, but I mean that people don't want to see his movies anymore. Like, I definitely do. I think the Ronan Farrow letter that he sent out before Cafe Society, like, I mean, especially for a Woody Allen movie that I think, I didn't watch it, but for the most part, people thought was good. Like, when a Woody Allen movie is good, it gets way much more coverage than Cafe Society got. And I'm pretty sure, like, a lot of that is because Ronan Farrow, the son of Woody Allen, sent out a letter before the movie was released, basically, like, condemning his father for, you know, the allegations or the sexual assault allegations against his own daughter. And I think that definitely, because I mean that's Woody Allen now. Like, he makes one good movie for every four bad ones, and the one good one he makes like always gets Oscar discussion, and like that's not happening with Cafe Society.
Yeah, but I've also heard not good things about Cafe Society.
It's more the reviews are technically like good. It's like on around 70, but that's not like Blue Jasmine level
or Midnight
acclaim.
Paris.
Right, exactly. Yeah. This is one of his lesser movies that's actually still kind of good. I enjoyed Cafe Society. That doesn't mean that that doesn't mean I'm applauding Woody Allen. No, of course not, but
no,
if we're doing this
like in terms of like categorically, like comparing, you know, these two people, like Jared Leto.
We're not. I'm not comparing them.
Because they shouldn't.
Right.
No, but it's just like people.
Yeah, you
people's
can compare,
priorities
you can compare their reactions to them. I'm not comparing them.
No, but I mean, like, no. I mean, what Woody Allen did was way, 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 way worse.
Well, that's
like,
what I'm saying.
Yeah,
like, people have a double.
But I don't
standard,
know. But like, I mean,
because it's easier to hate Jared Leto.
It is right now.
Yeah,
and it'll move on once. Like, let's say, like, let's all go off on a limb really quickly. Villeneuve hasn't really failed us ever.
Well,
statement?
And if he's really good in the movie,
he will be. I mean, there's still a 5% chance that he's bad because he just doesn't take off the Joker makeup or something. But possible.
Well, and my thing is, it's just like I just have never been like, I mean, prior to like all this Suicide Squad stuff, like I was never really like a big fan of his to begin with. Like I thought he was okay in like Dallas Buyers Club, but that feels like such a. Like, that's the type of performance that wins an Oscar, so it's just, like, it was fine, but, like, it's not...
Well, I never saw Mr. Nobody, which apparently he was really good in. Have you guys seen Mr. Nobody?
No, yeah, I mean, and there's
John
Requiem...
John Lennon shooter guy.
Hmm?
The John Lennon shooter movie.
No, that's a different movie, isn't it? Mr. Nobody came out... Or maybe it is, actually. I think Mr. Nobody is a different movie than his John Lennon movie, where he gained a lot of weight, right?
Oh, wait. Yeah, you're right. You're right. That's a science fiction movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jacob and...
I gotta check out that movie. But yeah, so Jared Leto, with all of, you know, what we've set aside, him in a movie with Denis Villeneuve, he's a talented actor, and we see this cast in front of us. The movie comes out, by the way, you know, sooner than we think. It comes out next November, is that correct? I just had it and then I lost it.
Did we talk about
October 6th of 2017? So that's basically a year away from now. That's pretty exciting news.
Did we talk about Barkov Abdi being in this movie?
Yeah, I mentioned him after or before Dave Bautista. This cast is insane.
No, I know, but
we didn't really talk about
it. That's very cool that guy's got work again.
So when I went to see Eye in the Sky...
Yeah, he's in Eye in the Sky.
I went to see Eye in the Sky thinking that he was going to have like a minimal role. He's like a huge character, and his arc matters in Eye in the Sky.
He's really
good. He might be my favorite performance in that entire movie.
Wow.
I mean, probably.
So, Eye in the Sky, really?
Yeah. He's like great.
Eye in the Sky is a good movie.
And not only is he great...
Well,
like,
it's gotten incredible reviews.
We saw his dramatic chops in Captain Phillips. He's super funny in Eye in the Sky, too, at times. Like, he's very light. He's light in his feet. He's charming. He's very charming.
I mean, he's kind of like a hustler.
He's a hustler. Yeah. He plays a hustler in this movie. But like,
that makes me very happy.
Yeah, so go check out Eye in the Sky. That's really an underrated film from this year that's kind of been forgotten very quickly. All right, let's move on, because we've taken up a lot of time on those two subjects. I've been debating back and forth whether I wanted to bring this up or not, because normally... We talk about casting news, but we don't usually talk about character reveals. but I feel like this is such a big character reveal that we need to at least mention it for a second, because we've already touched on this. Zendaya, the singer and Disney Channel star, had been cast in Spider-Man Homecoming a few months back, and we talked about that at length. Now it has been revealed she'd been, for this entire time, been cast as someone named Michelle. And everyone was kind of, what is Michelle really her name? And
who's Michelle personally?
Turns out Michelle is not going to be her actual name. Well, it might be her code name in the movie, but turns out she's actually playing someone else, someone we all know, named Mary Jane Watson. And this is the second Mary Jane Watson we've seen, I believe. Third, I guess, because Shailene Woodley was technically Mary Jane Watson in like a deleted scene that we never saw.
Yeah.
And then obviously Kirsten Dunst, great in Fargo, by the way, was
great in those movies.
She was, even though I couldn't stand their relationship. I just thought, like, I loved her, but I couldn't stand Peter Parker. I really thought he was a lame Peter Parker.
I like Tobey.
But those movies
I
are
like
great.
I like Tobey Maguire.
That's
in,
fine.
In those movies.
I don't want to get into that. But Zendaya, this is the youngest Mary Jane they've cast so far. This is the first non-white Mary Jane in these movies.
Yeah.
A lot of people are talking about it. I'm excited. I've never seen any of her work, but I am so damn excited for this movie as a whole.
She a Disney star?
And my favorite part about this movie, and correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, is that I've watched you go from not necessarily interested to every time we talk more about this movie, I feel like you're getting more and more interested for Spider-Man.
Well, after Keaton,
Keaton kind of set it off,
I'm all in. I mean, after Civil War, you know? After Civil War, that's when everybody kind of got
Keaton
excited
came
for this
back,
movie.
Right?
Keaton was on the project and then off the project. And then I was like, I don't really know. I didn't like Cop Car. I don't know. And then
Keaton's back.
Now Keaton's
and
back.
And then we got the guy from Fargo.
This cast. Here, let me run down
and then
this cast.
Zendaya playing the first African-American...
Mary Jane.
Mary Jane is...
Like, I mean, I would honestly feel like...
Pretty awesome.
Happy if it was the Russo brothers directing it. That would be the best thing for
they
me.
They can't do every movie.
But they just should.
I know, they should. They're amazing. I just want to... Like I said, I haven't seen Zendaya in really anything, so I can't say. But this cast is great, and I just want to run down the cast really quickly because it's nuts. Tom Holland, Robert Downey Jr., Anjiri Rice, who was a breakout star in The Nice Guys, Marissa Tomei, Donald Glover, who might be in the next Han Solo movie, Martin Starr, Michael Keaton, Zendaya, Logan Marshall.
Everyone else in The Martian.
Logan Marshall Green, the lighthearted Tom Hardy. Hannibal Buress, Michael Chernus playing the Tinkerer, Bokeem Woodbine.
Wait, Logan Marshall Green, the dude from The Invitation?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Michael Chernus, Bokeem Woodbine, who played Mike Milligan in Fargo Season 2, which was incredible.
Part of me wishes this was a miniseries.
Right? Kenneth Choi, who's back, who was in the Captain America first movie. Tony Revolori from The Grand Budapest Hotel. Tyne Daly, who some people think might be playing J. Jonah Jameson. Like, this cast is nuts. And Hannibal Buress, it keeps Michael Mondo from Better Call Saul. Like, this is might be...
Hannibal Buress
is in it. Like, whoa. This might be the best character cast. Like, I'm not talking about star power.
I mean,
power
that is way too many actors.
That is way too many actors.
I know, but what would be really funny if all those actors were just part of the PTA at the high school? Like, just like, they were just there for one scene. They were all yelling at, like,
or if it's just, like, a bunch of, like, 5-minute bits.
Or, like, teachers.
Yeah, teachers. That'd be fine. Yeah. I mean, this cast is Abraham Atta, who was great in Beasts of No Nation. Like, this cast goes on and on.
You know, this is
going to
be really crazy because it's the guy who directed Cop Car, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
John Watts.
Jesus. This is insane, the amount of, like,
good actors they got. The script must be good.
And that's funny because the script is from the people behind Vacation.
I know. You always bring
Goldstein
that up.
And Daly.
You love bringing that up.
Yeah. Well, they also, you know, they did Horrible Bosses, so that was a success in my opinion.
I like Horrible Bosses.
Yeah. And I liked Vacation. No one else in the world liked Vacation, but I liked Vacation because I'm juvenile and the jokes were like potty jokes. And I was like, oh my God, he said pee-pee. You know, and so like I thought it was funny. But I'm very excited for Spider-Man Homecoming, and I'm
Hollywood,
excited.
Listen, that's how you get a good review out of Reed.
Yeah, you just get me going about the Vacation, guys. But yeah, so I'm definitely looking forward to her as Mary Jane.
Yeah, this is going to be awesome.
When this trailer drops, hopefully, like, it comes out next July, and...
Christmas.
I would love it so much if it came out by Doctor Strange in November. If it came out Star Wars Christmas time, though, I'd be happy. Like, that's only a few months from... That's 4 months from now, which is crazy to think.
That Rogue One is that close.
And that, you know, we're almost in 2017 already. But man, Spider-Man Homecoming, this Marvel's doing everything right in my book right now, so I cannot wait.
Yeah, it's kind of hard not to be excited for a Spider-Man movie because, you know, he's a top tier.
He's always been my favorite comic book character ever. And I think this is his, you know, his interpretation in Civil War was so true to the comics and it was so great. And he was only there for like 10 minutes. He was there more than the Joker was. And the Joker and Spider-Man was never in any of the marketing.
It made way more of an impact.
Yeah, Spider-Man was in basically no marketing for Civil War. The Joker was in all of the marketing for Suicide Squad, and he was not even in the movie. So Warner Brothers, I know you're trying to take notes from Disney, but do a better job. All right, let's move on because we still got a couple more to go, and I'm trying to figure out which ones should take precedent. Let's talk quickly about the Hidden Figures trailer. This is another star-studded cast in a movie that's coming out around Oscar season, and there have been a lot of premature articles already saying that it's one of the front runners, especially IndieWire. IndieWire loves to jump ahead and talk about what movies are there in their opinion.
Well, IndieWire does like a lot of Oscar coverage.
Yeah, they do a lot of Oscar coverage.
What's her name? That one lady, I forget her name. She does the podcast with Eric Cohn, the IndieWire podcast.
Oh, Kate Erbland?
No, not Kate Erbland. She's like, her main thing is an Oscar. I'm sorry, I can't remember the
name. It's fine. We'll look into that. But yes, Hidden Figures, directed by Theodore Melfi and starring...
Anne Thompson, that's her name.
Okay. Taraji P. Henson, Octavia Spencer, Janelle Monáe, Kevin Costner, Kirsten Dunst, Jim Parsons, Mahershala Ali, who we'll be seeing in Moonlight, the A24 film, and who will also be in Luke Cage as Cottonmouth, Aldous Hodge. This is my favorite one. I shouldn't say this, but Glenn Powell's in this movie from Everybody Wants Some. So, like, you know, I'm very excited.
He's the military guy, right? Was he?
Military.
Remember the guy or the astronaut that was shaking their hands in the trailer?
Oh, in the trailer? He might have been. I didn't even notice him in the trailer.
Yeah.
Regardless.
Glenn Powell, man.
Glenn Powell. Regardless, this cast is nuts. Henson, Octavia Spencer, Janelle Monáe, Kevin Costner. Like, this is a great cast. The trailer for me, like, I don't want to be, like, a dick, but, like, the trailer seems so... forcing you to like get emotional, like it seemed like kind of lazy writing
and it seemed
very
repetitive.
Easy. It seemed repetitive. This could be an incredible movie, and the story is awesome. Like the story itself and the cast involved gets me interested because I think it's a story worth telling. But this feels like, I hate using the term Oscar bait because I think it's overused. But this is
Oscar bait.
This feels like Oscar bait.
It's total Oscar bait, and it sucks that Taraji P. Henson and Octavia Spencer have to be in a movie where like black women change the world every time that they're in a movie. Like, why can't they just be in a movie?
Well, I mean, it's that, and they have to be in movies, because, I mean, the truth is, it's that's not really the case, because they're in movies where it's 60s narratives of black women changing the world, so it's, like, not even in a context that's, like, modern, and these movies...
Yeah.
And that's what's annoying, because it's not even that. I mean, you mentioned Masahari Ali, and, like, this guy has been in so many, like, movies, and he's such a great character actor.
So good.
And he's excellent in all these things, and I mean, at this point, like, we have to acknowledge that this is, like, a genre and a trope in, like, Hollywood history where we like constantly like make these 60 narrative films that are like about like black empowerment, but they're always told, I mean, the guy who is directing this is like the guy who directed St. Vincent, like
Theodore
Melfi.
They're
always directed by these very like just middling bland white directors, and like, and it's one thing if like these movies are being directed by people like Ava DuVernay or like Spike Lee, or even, I mean, it doesn't even have to be them, but they're actually being handled like with some sense of like urgency, or like they're more introspective than just.
And
like,
to be fair, we don't know that this isn't being handled with that. We just from the trailer.
I'm not willing to give it the benefit of the doubt, because I mean, we have movies like The Help and The Blind Side come out every year that it's this same type of like, you know, mediocre director doing these types of films. Like I mean, in order to do movies like this in today's context, like they need to be socially introspective and they need to be willing to dig deeper under the surface, other than just like this common like trope of like good and bad that we always like see in these 60s films, where it's just like, oh, look at racism, and like they paint it in the most obvious and bad way, and they try to make it a simple equation of good and evil. There's so much more nuance in these historical narratives, and these movies completely just wash that away.
Yeah, so
most of the time.
I'm hoping that this movie doesn't do that, and maybe the trailer just isn't that great, because this cast is
well, and it's
awesome.
A shame, because like, yeah, I mean, these are really good actors, and like, frankly, like, you know, they're doing the best they can in the sense, like, I mean, they can't create the roles if they're not there. So like that's what makes it really messed up on some level. It's just like, I'm sure like they're all going to be excellent in it, and like they're doing the best they can, but like
nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah. But it's just like a cycle. And it is a shame that like these actors are better than this.
Yeah.
Hidden Figures is as of right now scheduled to come out in January of 2017, but it is fully expected to get a late December qualifying run.
So we'll see.
Definitely,
I mean,
keep an eye out.
Maybe the movie is better than the trailer looks.
Yeah. So hopefully it's better than that. How many topics do you think we have time for, Matt?
One more.
Let's do the last episode. We'll do two more. Sorry. We're going to do two more. Will Ferrell. And
oh yeah,
you want to talk about
this?
Good. I picked a good one.
Yeah,
Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, the two guys from Step Brothers, you might know them, and also Talladega.
Step Brothers, one of the best comedies of our generation.
Also, I think Talladega Nights is criminally underrated.
I love Talladega.
Talladega Nights is not underrated.
No one talks about it.
Yes, they do.
I don't. My friends don't talk about it.
Okay, well, I'm sorry. Your
friends are the end all be all.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, but Talladega Nights, Step Brothers. Talladega Nights weirdly more critically acclaimed than Step Brothers. Step Brothers now is getting a retrospective like, oh wait, that movie
it
was
didn't get great reviews when it came out.
Absolutely hilarious.
No, and I remember kind of being like split on it when I saw it.
Oh, when I saw it, I was like, that is the best movie of all time. my dad hated it. I took my dad to see it, and then Step Brothers is the movie that I quoted most when I was in high school.
Catherine Hunt is in that movie, right?
Yeah.
She plays the wife of Adam Scott.
Adam Scott is amazing.
He's such a bad person in that movie.
Yeah, I'm just happy. So they're doing a Sherlock Holmes adaptation called Watson and Holmes, right?
Yeah, it's called Holmes and Watson. Get it correct. So yeah, they're doing
this is the Sherlock Holmes we need.
So they're doing a modern day interpretation of Sherlock Holmes. It's going to be a PG-13. It's more of a comedy than I think any Sherlock Holmes.
Well, the Guy Ritchie movies just suck.
Yeah.
I hate saying that because it's Guy Ritchie, but yeah, that kind of sucks.
But they're just so like, even for like Guy Ritchie, like I think Man from U.N.C.L.E. is actually
the first
pretty
one.
Solid film.
I kind of like the first one. I don't remember the second one at all.
They're just so boring and bland, and like they kind of take like the worst things from like blockbuster filmmaking, where it's just like, let's add all this unnecessary action, even though like that's not really what Sherlock Holmes is about. Like,
also, Sherlock Holmes was a very gray. They were gray movies. Like there was not much color, and it was dark.
Oh, no, yeah.
It was rainy.
Well, I just hate like those over stylized, like almost like Zack Snyder-ish.
I knew
like
you were
going to
say
scenes.
That. I was thinking that too. I was like, it's kind of Zack Snyder-y. And then you said it. Good work there. So yeah, this is Holmes and Watson. It's going to be directed by Ethan Coen. I don't know his name off the top of my head. I'll have to look into what he's done. Or Matt, maybe you can do that. But it's spelled E-T-A-N Coen, C-O-H-E-N. And this will be a movie that they're actually going to get shooting very soon, and is looking to come out next year at some point. It's modern day telling of Sherlock Holmes, obviously with a comedy twist. Who's this director that's doing it?
He did Get Hard.
Oh, it's not Adam McKay.
No, if Adam McKay's, you know, he's gonna be doing some Oscar stuff for a while. No, he's not going back to.
He's gonna be making
the smartest thing he can do is go back to Will Ferrell movies. By the way,
I don't think so. I mean, he's done that. Like now, it's time for him.
No,
to
but I feel like
go get
he
some
can
Oscars.
Still do both. Like, why not? Like, well, interchange them.
Well, now he can do whatever the hell he wants.
And it's
he's
not
in
like,
that rare position.
It's not
now.
Like the other guys didn't have like some elements of like satire, and Talladega Nights has like a ton of
oh, of course. Yeah. But I think now he has a chance to actually work with legitimate A-list talent.
See, I kind of hate this because like, The Big Short is a comedy still. Like, it's not like he made like a serious... Like,
it's a dramedy. I think it's more of a dramedy.
No, but it's still a comedy, and it's still like structured
it's
like
funny.
A comedy.
It's funny.
No, no, but I think it's still definitely like very emblematic of like the way he makes movies. Like,
that's fine. I'm just saying that's The Big Short like, to me is like, nothing not, like Step Brothers, and it's nothing
no,
like
it's
Talladega
not,
Nights.
Well, I mean, the subject matter is more serious, but it's not like his filmmaking did a complete 180 in that
no,
film.
I'm just saying he has a different choice of stuff to do now. That's all I'm saying.
I disagree
no,
100%.
No, no.
Why
in terms
you say,
of just like
why,
how he structured...
Stop saying no to me.
No, like how the movie's actually like structured and the fact that it's still like... He's still shooting the movie like as a bunch of like comedy bits and like it's still like a lot of improv. Like it's still... The
except
comedy
that it's,
influence...
Except that it's like 100% not...
No,
like,
and you still have you, Matt. You still have.
Why are you getting so angry?
No, because you're just wrong on this. Because Matt, you have,
I love it.
Matt, you have
okay.
You have moments in The Big Short where he literally cuts away to Margot Robbie to these things like that. That's something
those
so
not,
out of
those are not
and they're like comedy
moments.
Bits.
Those
no,
are,
but like that's something like
that style that so he's clear. Never used before. Has he ever done that?
No,
before?
But it's so clear to see how like his comedy style is feeding into that, and that's like
I'm not saying the movie isn't funny, and I'm not saying there aren't scenes in the movie that are meant to be funny. That is so obvious, like. The movie is way
well, no, you're not
more
saying
than
that.
That. It's like, am. It is way more than that, though. That is style. That is a
no,
device meant for the audience. This is a completely complicated and convoluted idea that he needs to get across to the audience. He's using a device to get it across to the audience. And yes, it's funny, but it's not reminiscent of something like Step Brothers or Talladega Nights. It's just not.
That same approach to making a film, like, from a comedy perspective, from the fact that you can have these tangents, and not just even that, like just the fact that
but
how many of these the
but
fact that
Daniel,
this movie
they're not
is based,
tangents.
No,
they are integral to the plot.
They are but the way the movie's structured around ensembles, around like that whole Jenga bit, like that's done as a comedy bit.
No, but it's also it is
and that's all I'm
also
saying.
Integral to the
no,
plot.
No, it is, and I'm not saying
I think,
in a way,
I think it's more informative than it's meant to be.
Yeah.
Comedic. Like I agree that
that
it's
is
funny,
a scene meant
no,
to
but
be
I'm saying,
explaining to the
yes,
audience.
It is, but I'm saying that he's using some of the same techniques that you would use in a comedy film, and he's just reappropriating to more.
Here's what I think:
to more
just having scenes of.
I think what Adam McKay does in The Big Short, which is really underrated, is that he takes ways of exposition that have been used over and over again, and he kind of flips it on its head and does something fun with exposition to make it tolerable. And so I thought that was great, but I agree that it's a funny film, but I just think that The Big Short, and I don't know how we even got to this point, because we're talking about Ferrell, I get it, Ferrell and John C. Reilly.
He's not even directing the movie.
He's not doing this movie, but it would be cool if he was. I'm just saying, I think Adam McKay now, with the, he's going to have a lot more choices, and he's planning on working with Jennifer Lawrence in an upcoming film, where I think it's gonna have humor, obviously.
Well, no,
that's his bread
like,
and butter, but the drama's
like,
gonna be
like
more.
He hasn't turned into Ron Howard. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I don't think that's what we were saying.
I mean, it sounded like that. We're
why?
Just like, we're
I'm
just
not
like,
saying
why can't he make comedy films
what
anymore?
What exactly?
Like,
no, I'm saying.
I'm not
and
saying
The Big
he's,
Short is still, I think,
no,
like,
I,
in
what
a lot
I
of ways
said,
a comedy film. You obviously weren't listening to me. What I said is the smartest thing he could do is go back to making comedies. That is exactly what I said.
And I disagree with that. I think he should keep ride the wave and make more Oscar films, like, for him. Like, I mean, if he wants to. I think you go when the strike when the iron's hot. Like, I get it. If you want to go back and do comedies, sure. But I also say, why don't you get nominated for a couple Oscars and work with DiCaprio or Daniel Day-Lewis or something?
I just think for his legacy, it would be better for him to go back to comedies. It would be awesome. Like, that guy made some of the funniest movies of that generation and then got nominated for an Oscar for a film that was, yes, funny, but...
And still very much made like a comedy. That's my only point. Like, you can't deny that, like, that if someone else...
I just think that the fact that there are jokes
Ron Howard,
in that movie
No, but that type of movie, that type of plot can go to so many different directors. If Ron Howard makes that movie, that's a completely different film.
Okay.
And my whole point is that, like,
I just don't see your point.
It's still an Adam McKay film, and it's still... I think there's still so much, like... Like, you can see something like The Big Short and still see how, like, it's the same guy who made Talladega Nights, who made Step Brothers in some ways. And, like, I just think... I think you're dismissing that too easily.
I'm not dismissing it. I think you're dismissing his evolution as a director.
No, I'm saying that he was always that evolved on some level. I'm saying that
I think he was in the other guys. I don't think there's any... There's nothing in...
Oh, I disagree.
There's nothing in Anchorman or in Talladega Nights. Maybe I need to rewatch them, because I haven't seen... And I doubt you've seen them recently.
I've seen Talladega Nights very recently.
I've seen Anchorman.
So what are we... I kind of lost track what you're arguing about at this point.
No, he's saying that... The elements of his directing are heavily influenced in The Big Short. And I think he takes some of his comedic influences or his comedic tendencies into The Big Short. But all in all, I think he is a brand new and experienced and confident filmmaker
in
The
Big
Short.
I mean, and obviously, I mean, it's drastically different from those films in terms of just like the, like those movies... I think all like the political ideas and like satire.
I don't want to interrupt you. I just need to clear something out for me because you just said they were. I'm not trying to like trap you. I literally want you to explain to me. You just said now they're drastically different than The Big Short.
I'm saying that. Just listen. They're drastically different in the sense that in those other films, like he's still like those whole movies are about the subtext in terms of just like the satire in Talladega Nights and Anchorman. But in The Big Short, it's just open about it. And I think that's really the only difference in terms of just like. The filmmaking is different because of that, because he's not ostensibly trying to make like a Will Ferrell comedy anymore, but it's still coming from that same sort of perspective.
Maybe where we're differing is I don't see The Big Short clearly as a satire. I see it more as like a this is what happened.
No,
and
yeah.
I'm gonna spoon feed it to you.
I see Talladega Nights and Step Brothers more and Anchorman more as satire or more satirical than actually The Big Short. Like The Big Short.
The
Big Short is more along the lines of like a Wolf of Wall Street or a War Dog. Obviously, I'm not comparing.
Well,
to
I guess
quality.
That,
I'm just
I
saying,
hate
like,
I hate that War Dogs is in the same conversation.
Just in terms of
Wolf of Wall Street, is a far greater movie.
Right? No, I'm not.
Well, we haven't seen it.
We haven't seen it, but
I'm not comparing quality. I'm just saying in terms of subject matter and how it's being handled. But
I guess that's the distinction we should make here, where it's just like I guess I'm not surprised that someone like him would make The Big Short because all of his movies have a lot of political subtext, like those satire films, like they're satirizing. I mean,
the subtext is there, but I just don't know.
I mean, you're right. It's just like, yeah, The Big Short is.
Remember, he also had a lot of influence on The Big Short, not just in terms of directing, but he wrote the screenplay.
No, yeah.
So like, he had influence on how that movie was going to be portrayed. I'm excited to see him move on, and I'm excited for us to move on, and I'm excited for Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly to be Sherlock Holmes and whatever Watson's first name is. What is Watson's first name? Do we know?
Tommy.
Tommy Watson. Do you know Watson's first name off the top of our head?
No.
No one, poor Watson. No one knows his first name.
I think we should move on.
Let's
miss
how much we
done.
Like
no,
Adam.
No, no, no. To our, like, we should take a break and then go to the
You want
to
be done?
Yeah.
I was just going to mention something. We'll just jumble three things together in once. We don't even need to talk about it, but I think it's worth mentioning. bunch of Disney news this week. Ben Whishaw, who we just saw in The Lobster, who was great. He was in the James Bond movies as Q, I believe is his character's name. He was in charge of all the technology and stuff for James Bond. He has joined the cast of Mary Poppins Returns, directed by Daniel's favorite, Rob Marshall. So he'll be joining the cast, which already includes Emily Blunt and Lin-Manuel Miranda, so that's something to keep your eye on. Speaking of Lin-Manuel Miranda, he and Alan Menken are teaming up to make the music for Disney's upcoming Little Mermaid, which is like another Little Mermaid other than the Zoe Grace Moretz film.
I'm a little disappointed about that.
So they're doing that, like, and then one more bit of Disney news. Keira Knightley is joining the Nutcracker for Disney as the Sugar Plum Fairy. So quick thoughts, guys. Quick, on all three together. All right. What do you like? Do you like, dislike what Disney's doing with these
Keira Knightley, due for a comeback.
Yeah.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, get out of Disney.
Because he's already working on, you know, Mary Poppins.
Okay, so. Mary Poppins, Maua, whatever the hell.
Moana.
Moana, and this. That's three Disney movies.
I like it though, because Disney's getting good people to do this stuff.
I know, but if you got, I know this is like, I hope this doesn't come off as elitist or any way, but it's like, or hipster. Like,
it's going to.
If you guys listen,
if you guys knew
how good Hamilton is and how it is, literally, nothing else I've ever seen or ever listened to compares to that music. You would want this guy to do his own thing.
He's making it his own thing, though.
I feel like there's a scenario in which he could get enough power where, like, he can work in something like Disney. Like, I actually think there's a match there that can work if he kind of, like, steps more into, like, a directing, producing role.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I hate Rob Marshall.
Let me just say this.
I hope he gets fired.
All three of the... Yeah, Daniel and I also talked about Rob Marshall on the train yesterday.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah, we had a lot of conversations. These three things with Ben Whishaw, who I loved in The Lobster. I thought he was hysterical in that movie.
He was good in that movie.
And then, you know, Lin-Manuel, The Little Mermaid. I didn't think they were going to do The Little Mermaid because of Universal's with Chloe Grace Moretz, which Sofia Coppola dropped out of doing. And then, obviously, Keira Knightley. The Nutcracker's one that I'm actually legitimately looking forward to, because they've got the daughter. I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but the daughter. She was in The Little Prince. She played the little girl in The Little Prince. And she was also in Interstellar. She played Matthew McConaughey's daughter, the younger version. Of Jessica Chastain. She is cast in The Nutcracker. That movie sounds like it could be gorgeous. Like, I love The Nutcracker play, or the musical. I've been to it before in Chicago. So that could be really exciting. You guys all know, I love everything that Disney does, especially lately, and I just saw, we're going to talk about Pete's Dragon, but Disney hit another one out of the park with that one. Civil War is in my top five for the year. I love The Jungle Book. I really like Zootopia. And I like the BFG a lot. Did not see the new Alice in Wonderland, but I heard it's terrible. I need to check it out for myself. Disney seems to know what they're doing in every division, whether it's Pixar, I didn't even mention Finding Dory, which I also liked. I didn't love. They seem to know what they're doing in terms of Marvel, Pixar, Star Wars, Disney animations, Disney live action. Like, they are on their game. This might be the most efficient and effective Disney's been in their history, dare I say, like, in terms of how much content they're coming out with a year and how good it's being received and how much money it's making. Like, they're on a roll, and this seems to be all good stuff for me, so I'm cool with all of it.
Let's take a break.
Woo!
We'll be back here on Radio DePaul Chicago's College Connection with our review of Hell or High Water and Pete's Dragon. I think we'll just do Pete's Dragon first. Quick review, because it's just going to be Reed and I, and then we'll get into a little more in-depth review of Hell or High Water.
Formerly known as Comancheria.
Yes. Thank you, Reed. You're listening to Radio DePaul Chicago's College Connection. Here's a little music from Hell or High Water while we take a break.
Daddy's old LGO, and I lost my mind somewhere in New Mexico. And T.W. put a snake on my back. I keep a red bone on my side. Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio DePaul Chicago's College Connection. That was Outlaw State of Mind by Chris Stapleton. He is featured on the soundtrack for Hell or High Water, the new
formerly known as Comancheria.
Yeah, thanks, Reed.
I'm gonna keep doing that.
We're gonna be reviewing that next after we review Pete's Dragon from Disney. Here's a little bit of the trailer, starring Bryce Dallas Howard
and Robert Redford.
Sure,
I feel like he's worth mentioning, Matt.
I was out here at the Eastern Pad. But that's
50 miles east
from where we found him.
Hey.
Wait.
Do you know where your parents are? Your family?
My guess, he was on a picnic or a camping trip. He wandered off and got himself lost.
Been out in the woods, doing things his own way. Sounds like a boy after your own heart.
How long has he been out there?
6 years.
Nobody can survive in that forest for 6 years. At least not alone.
You'll see. I have Elliot.
Who's Elliot?
I need to get back to him. He gets scared when I'm gone.
Is Elliot a person?
No.
He looks like a dragon.
What's a dragon?
A dragon.
You don't have to run anymore, Pete. You can stay with us.
This thing is dangerous.
We don't want to leave you, but they'll come looking for you.
What's going to happen to Elliot?
You have no idea what this thing is capable of. Let's go hunting.
You're very brave. Did you know that? You might be the bravest boy I've ever met.
Esther!
Attention all units. We're eastbound on Millhaven Road in pursuit of a
dragon! It's a dragon!
You can't say dragon over the radio.
You can't say dragon over the radio. Well, guess what? I'm saying
we're
dragon.
Saying it now.
Dragon, 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 dragon. Bomb, 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 bomb,
dragon,
bomb,
dragon,
bomb.
Dragon, dragon, Adam McKay, dragon, dragon, dragon.
Reed.
Oh, man. So where do I start with Pete's Dragon? Should I give some background on what it's about?
Sure.
It's adventures of an orphan boy, spoilers, named Pete, and he becomes friends with a dragon dog. Let me just be clear. This is a dog with wings. A big, giant green dog. This is Clifford the big green dragon dog, who becomes friends, kind of raises a little boy named Pete, and they live in the forest together until a bunch of loggers come around and try to tear down the forest and build things with wood and manly stuff. This movie's directed by David Lowery, and it was a much less marketed Disney film than the other ones we've seen this year. Even the BFG had more marketing. Finding Dory, Civil War, you know, the list goes on. Jungle Book. This was a kind of a Disney film that seemed to be on the low end of the radar and almost forgotten, and it's coming out in August, so you'd think, okay, well, it'll be fine. In my opinion, this is the best movie Disney's done in recent memory. I can't think of a better Disney film off the top of my head in the last 5 years. I mean, I think Inside Out is the closest thing to this, and I think this might be better than Inside Out.
Are you including Marvel in this?
Yeah, I'm including Star Wars, including Marvel, I'm including the John Hamm baseball movie with the Indian cricket players.
Oh, it beat that.
Yeah,
it McFarlane beat that. USA.
McFarlane USA with
we Kevin reviewed Costner, that.
Which is it's a nice little movie.
I didn't. I think you that was I was out for that review.
Oh, really?
I kind of like McFarlane. Anyway, with all that background, I think this is the best Disney movie in a long time, and it's such a simple story, but the way David Lowery directs this, if you know the background, Disney literally said, make this movie however you want and we'll pay for it. And they didn't. He wrote this beautiful story about a boy who loses his family at a very young age and is literally raised by this dragon who is his pet dog and they're best friends. And it's a story of friendship and loyalty and
neighbors.
Love, like genuine love and childlike wonder, which is allowed for its adults. This movie treats its adults not like villains, which so many kids' movies do to a fine extent. Like, other movies do a good job where the adults are villains, but even the villain in this movie, played by Carl Urban, isn't really that bad. He's just more understood, and I like that. I like that there's no, you know, overbearing threat in this movie.
There's empathy.
There's empathy for everybody in this movie, and I can't stress enough how great the CGI dragon Elliot is, because this isn't motion capture like we've seen with the Planet of the Apes or with the Jungle Book. This is all visuals. So this kid is really hugging air, basically. And it's the most convincing CGI ever. And what I don't mean that it's the most realistic, because I think the Jungle Book takes the cake in that regard. Like, the Jungle Book is perfect. Like, that tiger looks real. That lion looks real. That ape looks real. This dragon doesn't look real because dragons can't look real necessarily, because they don't exist, because this is a giant dog with wings on it. However, and it's green, and it changes shades of colors of green. But what this movie does so fantastically is it allows it to be an animated character in this beautifully shot film. Like, this is a gorgeous film with great cinematography. The jungle looks great. I think we're in the northwest of America, like in Washington, somewhere along those lines. So it's a beautifully scenic film that takes place in the 70s, but it doesn't beat you over the head with the fact that it's the 70s. It kind of just allows you to realize that you're in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I love that about it. But man, I just loved how this movie pulls at your heartstrings, but it doesn't do it to do that. It's just, it comes naturally, because that's what this relationship was between this boy and this dragon. And it establishes also a great relationship between the boy and Bryce Dallas Howard's character. Robert Redford plays this like magical, hopeful character that I love so much. And
yeah,
I don't know if you guys can tell, I kind of like this movie. So I think it's a genuinely fantastic Disney film.
It's funny you saying that, and I didn't watch the movie, so I don't know why I'm talking.
Here comes Daniel's hate.
No, but it is interesting hearing you say that, because in some ways it reminds me of just how I felt about like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, where like you build like
that first one.
Yeah, I think, or Dawn.
No, Dawn is the first one.
Dawn? No, Rise is the first one.
Dawn is the second one.
Yeah,
which Rise is the better film.
Yeah, Dawn is.
They're
the
both good
one.
Though.
But Rise, in terms of just like the way you build this relationship with like this animal, and it's nice to hear that about the CGI, because you know CGI isn't supposed to look real. Like, it's supposed to look impressionistic. It's supposed to be dreamlike on some level. Like, it doesn't. I mean, if you can make it look photorealistic like you can in the Jungle Book and pull it off, like, that's great. But even then, like, there's more like color in that than I think people give credit for. Like, it's not 100% photorealistic.
And that's what makes this so beautiful, because, you know, you want to feel that sense of wonder.
Yeah,
and David Lally clearly does that. And he's not trying to make the dragon look, even though it looks great, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't look necessarily real. But it feels real because of the character development and the screenplay. Like, nothing, although there were a couple corny lines that, you know, Disney always has, everything just felt so emotionally honest and real. And I can't emphasize enough the word real enough. And I think that it was fantastic just the way the characters related to one another.
I liked your point about how this movie kind of sneaks up on you with its emotional crescendos. Like, it doesn't pull at your heartstrings overtly. And I feel that. I agree with you 100%. This movie sneaks up on you, and it takes its time, and it really builds this relationship in a subtle way. And it looks different than every other Disney movie. It really has this like strong visual sense, and it looks like a director really took his directing chops and directed this movie.
Right? It's crazy to see this
in a way that Disney movies usually don't feel like. You feel like his fingerprints all over, and you feel choices being made, and it's exciting. This movie is exhilarating at some points, and it's sad, and it's funny, and it's really great. I mean, when you text it in the group, because you're a very hyperbolic guy, every movie is the best movie.
No one's
of all
ever
time
accused me of being hyperbolic. Yeah. I don't know what
and
you're talking
so
about.
When you said it's the best Disney movie ever,
I didn't say ever.
I said it's the
best Disney movie in a long time.
In a long time, I was like, man, I'm gonna probably hate this movie.
You said it was the best Disney movie in the past 120 years.
Yes. After 120 years, maybe not so much.
Yeah. Steamboat Willie, maybe.
Yeah.
Nothing tops the original Peach Dragon. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah, I have not seen
the
1977.
I have not.
But man, I really fell for this movie. I really liked it, and I thought Bryce Dallas Howard is kind of perfectly cast in this film, and she is so natural.
So wonderful.
And Robert Redford has a really great role. It's just a really, really great movie. And I was in a theater with. You know, not many people, but there was a lot of babysitters like bringing their the kids, and there was a round of applause at the end, and a lot of people were going to like this movie when they see it.
There's a lot of discussions every time there's an animated movie or a movie meant for kids, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And like, is it actually meant for kids or is it meant for adults? I don't necessarily always love those conversations, but I think this movie is actually more fitted for adults.
Yeah.
Because so many of these themes are about growing up and not giving up on your dreams and loving one another and not, you know, destroying what's important. I think a lot of kids, like, this isn't like the loudest movie ever. This isn't a movie where there are jokes every second. I don't know if kids, like little kids, are going to love this. I think, you know, young adults, like preteens, are really going to like it. But I think the older you get, the more you're going to appreciate it.
Some of my complaints, they're not even complaints, they're just, I wish the movie had done more of something where the score was really good.
Yeah.
Really good. That kind of bluegrassy guitar plucking that happens, and it has this real momentum to it. And then it cues up these music, these actual songs, and they didn't totally work for me. I wish that they...
I had to go back because I was so swept up in the imagery, I kind of wasn't even paying attention to the music, so I need to...
That running scene when he's running from the hospital kind of deal, I don't want to spoil it. Yeah. That's a great scene, but
beautiful
also...
too, to look at.
But there's music, there's an actual song laid over top of it, and I really wish that he had utilized the score a little bit more, because I felt like that was where it really invoked a lot of the emotion that I got from their relationship in the beginning. That's when the score was really taking
over. Well, the score at the end hit hard. Like, I remember the grand sweeping, I think it was it reminded me a bit of almost Jurassic Park score towards the end when they're... Yeah. I can't spoil it, but what happens towards the end, it kind of feels very sweeping and gorgeous and lovely and bringing it all together to culminate the film.
I also felt like another minor qualm is there's a scene at the end, there's a moment at the end where two characters are in peril, and I didn't feel like that was totally earned. Like that
entire scene?
Just the moment with the... I don't want to...
Yes,
the bridge.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, the bridge.
It didn't feel earned on the side of somebody.
The reason why there's this big...
I know that's
the
super
movie
ambiguous.
Is,
it doesn't make
the
any
movie
sense,
is but. Very small in terms of Disney films for the entire movie.
Yeah.
And then it gives you a very typical Disney ending. But what's so great about it was it didn't last very long. And the movie had one trick up its sleeve that I completely forgot. Like, you know about it because if you know what dragons, you know what dragons are supposedly can do. And you completely forget about what dragons can do because this movie doesn't bring it up ever. And then the end comes, or one scene happens at the end, and I'm like, oh my god, this dragon can do that. And so I think that kind of saved that entire... It wasn't bad by any stretch, but it was the most conventional part of the entire movie.
Yeah.
And it was saved by this character doing something that was so breathtaking and wonderful and loyal and just like risked, like it was a risk, and he was sacrificing himself in a sense, and it was just great all around, and every character cared about the other.
So those were my only real complaints, and they weren't really even complaints.
Right.
Like that moment at the end that I didn't really totally buy was, you know, it was like 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the way the dragon looked. The design of the dragon was so...
You mean the dog?
Interesting. The fur was so awesome, and whoever designed the dragon really deserves...
I'm gonna try to figure that out.
It's incredible.
Well,
because
David Lowery designed the dragon.
Because the original Peach Dragon, I was looking. It's just, you know, it looks like a dragon.
Or it looks like a reptile.
Yeah, it looks like a reptile. This has fur, and it looks more reminiscent of like a horse. Even it's really
well. David Lowery did design the original concept art for this dragon, and so that's where he went. And this movie's clearly appealing to dog lovers, by the way.
Yeah.
Like this is if you hate dogs and you're a cat person, maybe, you know, this should be called Peach's Big Dog. Like, that's really what it is.
So at the end of the day, this is a really, really solid Disney movie.
It's 2,000 pound dog.
I agree with you. I think it's the best Disney movie outside of the Marvel movie of this year. I thought it was better than...
Well, do you think it's
Zootopia? I thought it was better than
Jungle Book, Finding Dory.
Or to give it,
I didn't see Finding Dory.
I still
so.
To give
Dory,
it a little bit more context. Do you think it's the best out of like this whole new wave of like Disney remaking these classics?
Yeah, the live action ones. Yeah, I think it is.
And it's, I love Cinderella. Cinderella was magical, but I think this is on another level.
It's definitely the best one. Yeah. It's definitely the best one so far. Really awesome. Going to get a nod for top 10 list this year. I don't think it's going to be on my top 10 list, but
you'll think about it.
I'm excited to see this.
It'll be in the conversation. Then again, I'm going to give you some caveats. It is very conventional.
But the way the conventions are laid out is different. Like,
yeah.
This is just a different...
It is...
Because, yes, the story is very formulaic in a sense. Like, there's a boy and his pet, and the pet wants to get taken away, and then, oh my god, the day is saved.
Yeah.
Yes, but there are so many nuances to this film and subtleties that are brought together by just simple character development that, like, save it, like, where other films just don't give you the time or day.
The movie also just looks different. It looks... it has a visual sense that.
Well, you kind of hear this all the time with a smaller director. Right. People on the cast are like, yeah, he made a big budgeted indie film. And everyone's like, okay, everyone says that. This kind of does feel like that, kind of. In the sense where he, David Lowery, was given kind of, given the ropes completely. And not to the extent of, more to the extent than someone like the Russo brothers, because the Russos still have to answer to Kevin Feige more.
Well, yeah.
But the Russos have, you know a Russo brothers superhero movie now when you see one.
Can kind of be standalone in a way that those films can, and that's nice to hear in the sense that I mean I still need to see it, but
see you don't see it in theaters. That's my recommendation.
But it sounds like the movie's very like smart and nuanced in terms of how it uses the dragon, and just like it's very calculated.
And that's a great point because you haven't seen it, but it's true because the dragon isn't in the movie. He's in the movie a good amount, but he's not in the movie as much as I.
And it's not his movie,
right?
It's Pete's movie.
Exactly. That's great for the title. Like it's Pete's dragon. Like. Elliot the Dragon is in the movie of his fair share, but he's not in it that much. So when he's in, you care immensely because of the setup at the beginning. And pay attention, by the way, I want to say this, to Elliot's eyes, the dragon's eyes, because there's a scene where the dragon is going looking for Pete in one scene in the town. And just the way his eyes wander looking for this kid feverishly, like trying to find his friend, that really struck me. And there are a lot of moments of this movie where I needed tissues. I'll be honest with you. Like this was the hardest I can't believe I'm admit this is the hardest I've cried in a movie since Toy Story.
We should also mention the kid.
Yes, Oakes Fegley.
He's great
as Pete.
Always convincing. Doesn't give a traditional.
Kind of looks like Jacob Tremblay a little bit. He kept reminding me of Jacob.
But
just the hair. Yeah, that's
hair.
What.
But I
he had some Tarzan elements by the way.
Now I'm just thinking about it. I still love this movie. I wish the movie had been a little bit less conventional in its ending in terms of I wish that it was a little I can't talk about it without spoiling it. It's still great. I'm going to give this like a 9. I think this is an awesome movie.
Giving this a 9.5. This is just an amazing, and it's so surprising that this movie comes out in August with the next movie that we're about to view that we really liked that came out in August. Like this is August is supposed to be the new or the summer version of January where all these movies are terrible. Yet we keep getting movies with great
reviews.
Every
other month was August this summer.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So like August is really making up for the Junes and the Julys, and this weekend we got Kubo, you know, another movie that's gotten great reviews. So
well, what's the budget on this film?
$60 million. See, which is very small for a Disney big budget film.
Small.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and
there's not much CGI in this movie, though.
Other than
this movie's
the dragon,
very
right.
small. This movie is very small. It's all the dragon. The money is in the dragon. You
That's
can
it.
See it.
There are no, other than the ending, there are no
and
big.
The cast is not extravagant. Carl Urban's like a big character in this film.
Wes Bentley's a big character.
Wes Bentley's a big. And he's, great. He's great in this
I
movie.
Love, by the way, Wes Bentley, like, this guy needs to have his research.
He's very good.
Because he's really good in We Are Your Friends, the Zac Efron DJ movie that I actually really enjoyed.
Okay, relax. That movie's. Freaking horrible!
But you think it's horrible. I think
I'm in the majority.
You're technically in the majority.
I'm in the majority.
You're in the majority. Robert Redford, he's not in it a lot, but he also narrates this movie, and just his level of care for the kids in this movie. Like he's great with the kids that he talks to, and he just plays this guy that you root for right from the beginning because he's kind of seen as an outsider, and his story is wonderful. And this is a truly magical film.
Awesome. Let's get. Do our review of Hell or High Water, which we have all
formerly known as Comancheria.
Seen. Thanks, Reed.
You know, the bank loan just enough to keep your mama poor. Thought they could swipe her land.
It's a big bank.
It's too big. That's what she said.
Now they can foreclose on Friday. So come hell or high water, get the money to the bank on Thursday. And then you are free and clear.
Little brother, let's go get that money.
Good morning, folks. Open the drawers.
You got a gun on you, old man?
You're damn right I got a gun on me. Y'all gonna steal my gun, too?
We ain't stealing from you, we're stealing from the bank.
You hear about these bank robberies? You may get to have some fun before they send you off to the rocking chair yet.
I may have one hunt left in me.
Mama, hasn't that been a while?
3 months.
Bank breathing down her neck.
Everybody get on the ground!
Y'all been here for a while?
Long enough to watch a bank getting robbed has been robbing me for 30 years.
How'd you manage to stay out of prison for a year?
It's been difficult.
Don't stand up!
These boys know exactly what they're doing. They're trying to raise a certain amount, that's my guess.
Let's go!
Toby,
It's a good thing it does.
More down it.
Every step of the way. You want a little advice? Go see your boys and mom.
You know, you talk like we ain't gonna get away with this.
I've never met nobody got away with anything, ever.
And why in the hell did you agree to do it?
Because you asked, little brother.
Mama, take this badge off of me.
I think I got these boys figured.
He's got no record. He's never been arrested. He don't fit the bill, Marcus.
You may be hearing a lot of things about me and your uncle.
It's getting dark, too dark to see.
Whatever I hear, I won't believe.
No, you believe it. I did all of it.
Love you, Toby. Mean it.
Love you, too.
You want to get us killed? Huh?
Welcome back to Radio DePaul Chicago's College Connection. That was a little bit of the trailer for Hell or High Water.
Formerly known as Comancheria.
Thank you, Reed. Directed by David McKenzie, who previously did Startup.
Written by Taylor Sheridan, who previously did Sicario. And the upcoming 9 Sicario sequels.
Yes. Thank you, Reed. Daniel, what do you think about this movie?
Yeah, I have not seen Startup, so this is actually the first film I've seen by David McKenzie. And it's actually funny because he's actually made movies before that for like 10 years, but it seems like Startup is really where his career has really taken off. And I don't think I'm quite as in love with this movie as you guys, but this is such an impressively self-assured film just from top to bottom, not only just in terms of the direction, but the script is so finely tuned. And I think the way in which it kind of, you know, I mean, we've had this discussion on the show before in terms of just like the Western genre and how it's very hard to make just a straight up Western nowadays. You always have to add it into some sort of other genre, or, you know, basically, you basically
cowboys and aliens.
Oh yeah, well that's horrible, but yeah, it's along the lines of that. But to see a movie that is kind of like a modernized, you know, straight up traditional Western, and done this well was so impressive. And I think what I found most interesting about this film is the way, and especially someone who grew up in Texas, like I do think it does reach a level of authenticity where this movie is all kind of about the mannerisms of like Southern society and specifically Texas and the way that it's changing and evolving and how you have these characters who want to like hold on to the sense of tradition. But and I actually found it interesting that too. And I like that the movie actually acknowledges, even though, I mean, it's still definitely from the perspective of, you know, the Jeff Bridges character, how it acknowledges that like Texas is this kind of changing state and like the amount of different type of people who kind of live in this environment and the way they're kind of forced to interact. Like, I think the movie is, it's most fascinating when it's really dealing between, you know, the mannerisms between these two characters and really, you know, in some ways like an unexpectedly, and I didn't really expect this coming into the film, like a really interesting commentary on just evolving social norms and just like political incorrectness and like who is leading that discussion and like the dynamics of it. And that's before we actually get into the actual plot of the film in terms of just...
Right. Well, I can kind of start out with the plot of the film. Again, spoilers, I really love this movie. Same weekend as Peach Dragon, which is hilarious to me. Same writer as Sicario, which is one of my favorites of last year. Startup was fantastic, so you know going in that this could be something special. And I feel like a Western about bank robberies is something that we kind of needed. Like, there hasn't been that type of... We've seen bank robbery movies. We've seen, like, Inside Man. We've seen... Or Inside...
The Town.
The Town. I want to see that... The Town is kind of a neo-Western kind of a way.
And I guess you could say that's how this movie is sort of bridging the gap, is the heist element.
But also what this movie brings back, in, like, kind of these old-fashioned Westerns have, which a lot of the current Westerns don't, is humor. This movie is a joke a minute, and I did not know that coming
Very
in.
Very funny.
This is a legitimately hilarious... Like, you guys were talking about if The Big Short was a comedy or if it was just funny... I think this is more of a comedy than The Big Short is, which is crazy because I think the drama...
I would not agree
because
with
I think
that
that's fine, but I think I mean, I laughed much harder in this movie than I did in The Big Short.
No, yeah.
And this movie also has much darker moments than The Big Short ever even gets to, and that's a dark movie.
That's arguable.
It's arguable, but yeah. I would say this movie gets even a little bit darker, and there
this
are
movie's more personal.
There are more, it is, but yeah. There are more similarities to the financial crisis in Hell or High Water than you would
expect. Well, this movie is about that.
It's about The Big Short, kind of, you know, if you want to do a prequel or a sequel, yeah. I suppose.
Or a double feature.
But besides what this movie is like, you know, what this movie is actually about, the plot, it's all about characters, and it's about two relationships. It's about the relationships between Jeff Bridges' character and Gil Birmingham, his partner's character, and it's about Chris Pine and Ben Foster, and boy, are they so believable. Two were brothers in Chris Pine and Ben Foster, and Gil Birmingham and Jeff Bridges, they're basically brothers because they work together, they go off to different motels, and they live together when they're chasing these criminals. They know each other by heart, and this movie just understands how people talk, or how these people in this community talks to one another. They treat each other like crap half the time. They constantly riff on one another. They insult each other. It's all out of love. And I love how this movie lets it grow. It actually develops an actual legitimate conversation between Birmingham and Jeff Bridges that's important, and it turns into something which I originally thought was just like riffing and, you know, racism, which it was, but it also turns into a learning moment for Jeff Bridges, and it didn't feel heavy-handed
either. That's the thing about the movie. That's why this movie transcends from being good to legitimately pound for pound the best movie of the year, is it has so many things to say, and it's not,
and it questions itself as well,
and it's not overt about them, and it is they're
and the way
they are inextricably linked to the DNA of this movie, the ideas that it's presenting, the ideas of legacy, the ideas of money, the ideas of land and who owns it, and it's
I'm glad you brought that up, because like, I mean, I kind of brought up the whole Stillshot angle, but it does go much deeper than that in terms of just like a commentary and just like corruption in American society. Even like, there's so much in this movie that
desperation.
Yeah.
Well, it also has, there's a lot of talk of, you know, male machismo, or like this macho attitude that a lot of these movies wouldn't have, they would have acknowledged, but they would have never, you know, been subversive at all. This movie is that. This movie takes a look at its characters, and I mentioned, and I did kind of a smaller written review where I said, this movie doesn't judge any of its characters, but it also doesn't let any of its characters off the hooks for any of their things. Like Ben Foster repeatedly gets what's coming to him, but yet the movie never judges him because it allows the love between Ben Foster and Chris Pine to come through.
And it's smart enough to let the audience make that decision for themselves. Like
absolutely.
It lets you, and that's what I actually really do admire about this film in terms of just like, and in some ways that's where I think there's a link between this and, you know, a Coen Brothers films, not just in terms of just like how well made it is, but just having the confidence is just like, I'm going to let you see these characters and let you more or less make the decisions for yourself.
This really felt like a Coen Brothers movie.
In terms
of
just like where you think these characters land on the morality spectrum. And I think on that level, like there's a really, like the duality of this film between, you know, the two pairs of partners is really nice. And I like how in some ways, like they're kind of like, in some ways, opposites, in the sense that, you know, with Chris Pine and Ben Foster is kind of the outspoken one.
Right.
And with Jeff Bridges and Jeff Bridges is the outspoken one. And I do I do think it's interesting how it kind of flips those roles in both cases. I mean, obviously, Ben Foster is the more crazy, is the most craziest character in this film, but I do like that him and Jeff Bridges probably have more in common with each other than...
And it's good. They have a final moment which matters. And then, you know, there's the ending. We talked about it at length once we all saw this movie together. The ending goes in a way where I didn't expect, because I thought it was going to end at a certain point. And then it goes on an extra five minutes, which is so important.
And I think that's why...
That is the most important scene in the movie, is the end.
The actual ending.
And I think that's what made me appreciate the film more after the fact, because at least watching it, I was a little... I was engaged in the film, but... It felt like a little done there, been that, in terms of just...
Exactly.
It's, I mean, it's totally riffing on the genre conventions.
This is so...
But it subverts them really intelligently.
This is so conventional.
No,
this is in the best way possible.
No,
It is. It feels timeless. It feels classic. It feels like...
With a modern spin on it.
Exactly. And there are all these beats that you just totally... You see coming. Like these...
But I didn't, and here's why.
No, not the plot points, but the way these characters...
Right. I see what you're saying.
The way they evolve, the way they're set up in the beginning. Jeff Bridges, this is his last investigation. On the verge of retirement,
Two guys on their last heist, basically.
Exactly. And we've seen this time and time again, but the movie manages to subvert it at every moment and also make it seem fresh again.
And we mentioned the humor, and a reason why I think the humor is like arguably the most important facet of this movie is because there is so much tension at the end and towards the finale, which I don't think would work if there wasn't humor throughout, because the humor helps us build a caring for these characters that I don't think we would have felt the way if the movie took itself too seriously. And for the first two-thirds, it definitely takes itself seriously, but it also allows its characters to have fun, and there are constant jabs at one another, and there are hilarious jokes after hilarious jokes after hilarious jokes.
Yeah.
And because we've become so comfortable with these characters, when they're actually in danger or there's a fear of death, we're like, no, 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 don't do it. Oh, my God, I'm on the edge of my seat. I think that worked tremendously.
A lot of filmmakers do not employ comedy in a way that is as effective as this. Like, comedy is a way to endear us to these characters. It's a way to make us care more.
100%.
And it's easy. It's not easy, but it is quick. You have to do more work in terms of, like, you have to write the jokes and you have to make them feel natural. But once that work is done, you only need a couple, you know, a couple moments of that, a couple moments of laughter and, you know, to make us really connect.
No, and actually, I have two things to say, but this is, the first one is kind of bouncing off what you say, is that, I think, I mean, that's what the movie does so well, and I think in terms of just, like, screenwriting, like, this is just excellent screenwriting in terms of these relationships, and the whole movie just has this sense of being lived in, and you totally, and that's something that, I mean, and it's really everything coming together in terms of just, like, the performances, the dialogue, the direction, being smart enough to pick up on those things, where you totally believe these relationships between all these characters, you totally buy into the dynamics, and you totally, I mean, especially with, like, Jeff Bridges and, Gil
Birmingham.
I'll learn his name by the end of this. I mean, you buy that, the extent of that relationship and how many years they've known each other. The one thing that I think is maybe holding me back a little bit, and it's not even something that I really consider a flaw, but it's just something right now that I'm thinking about that maybe I just didn't, it didn't resonate with me emotionally. I feel like Ben Foster's character didn't totally work for me in the sense that I thought he was great in the film, but maybe it's just because he felt to me like the most kind of cliched part of the film in terms of just like this outspoken,
the loose cannon.
Yeah. And I feel like the movie never, like, it was commenting on that, but I never feel like it truly transcended that into something truly original with that character.
Well, I think it is because he,
I mean, there is that one really good moment in the casino, that one line.
The joke?
Yeah.
When they're leaving?
No, that when he's playing like poker, right?
Right.
And then he has like that confrontation.
That guy.
Yeah. But like, I feel like I see like the big moments like that they're like leading up with this character. I just feel like I didn't think he was like a detriment to the film.
Well, what's so great about that is they subvert that because they set him up as the loose cannon, the one that's going to go crazy. And then there's a scene at the gas station which flips it on its head and allows Chris Pine to do something.
I forgot about that moment.
Yeah. And that's actually a really good moment.
And that scene is perfect because you're expecting the nut job. You're expecting Ben Foster to do something crazy.
That's a really good point.
And then Chris Pine comes out of nowhere. And that's why this movie is so effective, because when you say it's conventional, the storyline is kind of conventional, but the way it handles its characters are so unconventional, and it's beautiful in the way
it all
comes
together. But I feel like, I guess
he
never like completely, I never felt like he was ever completely removed from that archetype in the way that I felt like Chris Pine.
I could see that.
Or especially like Jeff Bridges. And I feel like we actually haven't talked enough about him.
I think we should just talk about the actors in general.
Jeff Bridges was incredible. And to go back to that point you brought up with the gas station, I mean, that to me is an example of just like how confident and self-assured this filmmaking is. And granted, like, I feel you can do that when you have a script that's this good.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, and the movie is so beautiful in the terms of like, these wide shot compositions were
gorgeous to look at,
and you literally just get to see both of these characters like interact in full frame, and literally playing that moment in the gas station just like as one more or less like full long take. Like it's such an effective filmmaking, and there's so many examples where
the camera move in that gas station scene. Like, I'm trying to think.
I feel like it hardly does.
I think it's so great how for the. A long, I can't spoil the scene, but for a long portion of that scene, the camera just sits there and watches from the entire, you see the entire gas station and you see how it unfolds, and I think that is so cool.
Well, and there's that opening shot.
Yeah.
That's very bold.
When we see the town, we see portions of the town before the bank.
Oh, no.
And when she's walking into the bank.
The opening shot of the opening bank robbery, it's that one shot where it's circling and circling.
I know, when you see the lady getting ready to go into
the
work.
Yeah, and then we follow them in, right. And that whole, that's, you know, one beautiful shot. The David Mackenzie really, you know,
he definitely watched Sicario, and he watched that border driving scene.
Well, not only that, you can tell he just watches a lot of movies.
Yeah,
and
that too.
And a lot of Westerns, and just, I mean, there's a real sophisticated sense of, like, visual storytelling here that was just really surprising to see, because, I mean, this is literally, I mean, in terms of just, like, pure filmmaking level, like, this is, like, Coen level, like, and it's, you don't see that every day when you see someone who's that intelligent about how he actually uses cameras and shots to tell a story. It's really refreshing.
Well, we should talk about Chris Pine.
Well, I was going to say, as we approach September, I think this is clearly, in our, at least Matt and I's opinion, the best movie of the year. And I think this is
the
first truly Oscar type movie. I'm not saying it's, you know, there are people that might think, you know, Everybody Wants Some or The Witch is the best movie, but I'm talking about in terms of what kind of movies the Oscars look for. I feel like this is that type of film.
It's somewhere on the list for
so
me.
Who are your Oscar noms for every category in this movie? Do you have Oscar noms like going in right now? Like,
not really. I don't think anybody stands out because they're all so good and right. they're all so natural and they fit into this film so perfectly. And but really the standout for me, the performance that I keep coming back to and I keep thinking about is Chris Pine. I think Chris Pine, this is his best performance.
It is.
It's very low key for her.
He uses his charisma in ways that are surprising, and also he pulls back. And this performance is quiet.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point.
It's confident.
He's the thing about Chris Pine, which is so great, and
his eyes, man. Yeah,
he's got some good eyes.
The way he uses them it is a skill.
Similar like Elliot.
Exactly right. it is a choice. He is making a choice with the way he uses his face and the way he smiles and the way he. And when he chooses not to, and you can just see him making choices, I see him acting in a way that you just
no, but yeah, that's all in the eyes.
There is a performance there, and this is his best performance. Well,
and I'm glad that you actually mentioned like how he's still using his charisma in this role, because he's still Chris Pine and he's still like this incredibly, you know, good looking dude. And I like how the character and like the performance knows when to play into that subtly, like at times, and like
this performance felt. Like in an alternate universe, he is the biggest movie star on the planet. Like
no, yeah,
like 50 years ago, he's the biggest star Hollywood has ever seen.
No, yeah, and it's funny.
And he's starting to get to that. I mean, I think
his time has passed.
I think it's coming up. He's still got Wonder Woman. He has this. Like he had just had Star Trek, which
I know he's in. Like he's in big movies. I'm talking about movie star level, like
Eastwood or something.
Yeah, Eastwood,
okay. Or like Gary Cooper,
DiCaprio,
John Wayne.
John Wayne, like.
Right,
those guys.
Well, and actually, I think that's actually really interesting, because I think, you know, there's an element to Chris Pine where it's just like, I mean, I think his time has passed, not necessarily even because of his career, but just like the generation we live in. Like, there's not.
No, there are no movie stars.
There's no room for Leonardo DiCaprio anymore. There won't be another. Like, he's the last of.
I don't know if he's the last, but I think in every era, there's going to be one or two actors where you pay to see money for, and Leo's one of them.
It's so narrow at this point, and it's just like, you could totally see, like, if this guy was, like, an actor during the 50s, 60s, or 70s, like, how big he would be, and just like.
He'd be huge.
But I think for me, my favorite performance, and it's all maybe just because I'm just a huge fan of his, but I love Jeff Bridges in this film.
He's really good.
And it's just the way that he's just able, and I mean, and this is a guy who just knows how to use like these tics to really make a character work, and just like the drawl he has, and just like
he's so Texas in this movie.
Oh yeah, Texan, and just like the way like he's kind of hunched all the time, like there's just a way like. He's so lived in that character that I think it brings up so much of a sense of just like, you look at this guy and you already get a sense for who he is.
Well, he's always relaxing. He's always sleeping.
He's always kind of slouched.
Yeah, he's always laying down. Yeah. He has his hat over his eyes. Like he's really building that character from the ground up.
And just like how gravelly his voice is. Like
I love how this is the film. Like I feel like we were waiting for the last film of the Jeff Bridges like late era renaissance of, you know, True Grit, Crazy Heart, and then now we finally have like the trifecta of like these are the performances that you look at when you would think of Jeff Bridges, you know, post 80s Starman quality. I think
Iron Man and you look at this
especially Lebowski. You'll look at Starman, you look at Lebowski, and then you'll look at his late career stuff, and I think now we finally have a third performance that is as strong as the True Grit and the Crazy.
Yeah. This isn't me being hyperbolic, and I'm genuinely asking this question, but I think not just in my opinion, but in terms of Oscars, like I think he's probably the clear favorite supporting actor.
I just disagree with you in terms of this movie getting Oscar.
No, I'm not saying it's not going to. I don't think it is. I'm just saying as of right now, I think he probably gets a Best Supporting nod. Who else year?
I would actually give him a lead nod.
Yeah, he's not going to.
He's not a lead in this movie.
No.
But
they're
not
going. No,
he's
not. That they campaign him in supporting.
I'm going to give this, I think we'll just go to numbers now, because I think this is the best movie of the year. I don't think I've given a movie this grade this year. I'm going to give it like a 9.8. I think this is near perfect. near perfect. I think everybody should see this movie. I can't wait to show.
Yeah, this movie coming out in August is a legitimate disgrace, in my opinion. I think Lionsgate screwed up badly by releasing this movie in August. And just in terms of the fact, this is me wanting this movie to do well award season. I think it would clearly do better in November.
I think his intentions are good. Your intentions of
No.
He wants more people to see
it. I'm not saying that, I want this movie to be more.
No,
the fact that it's in August, I think, is just bad marketing and bad strategy from Lionsgate.
No, yeah. I think, I see what your point is. And I think in terms of distribution, because I do think this movie is good enough where it can cross that divide and potentially get Oscars. But there's a part of me that's just like, this movie is so legitimately good in a way that so many of those Oscar films aren't, that I feel like putting that label of that this is an Oscar movie on it, I feel it's just like degrading.
No, I just wish it was. It's not an Oscar movie because I don't think this movie is going to be.
Because this movie is just like legitimately just a well-crafted film.
And it's going to be forgotten, I think.
Like, this isn't The Imitation Games or something like that. It's so much, much more beyond that. I think for myself, I still wanted like have more time to think about this film because I think this movie has so many themes and so many ideas that it's unpacking. I think, you know, just watching it once, like, I think it does require another viewing. But I think for now, I'm going to give it a 9.
I'm giving this movie a 10. I mean, I'm not saying it's the best movie ever made, but it's, to me, it's a perfect film for its genre this year. I loved it. It's my favorite movie of the year. I loved Gil Birmingham, just because, you know, the three other actors are such well-known names that he's going to become forgotten in this. But he was so great right next
to
Jeff Bridges.
He was awesome.
And their conversations together. Awesome. Like, you think for a while, I was starting to think for a while in the film that Jeff Bridges is really laying into him and this guy doesn't say anything back. And I'm like, I wonder if something's coming.
He's building up.
No, yeah, exactly. And when he does, it's so great, that conversation that they have. And the best part is, Jeff Bridges' reaction is just to listen, and I think that's really important.
But that's the thing about this movie is there are, you know, there's you know, masculine jabs back and forth, and then when it comes to it boils over into real monologues about like life and about the way
there's self-reflectiveness too, which is so important.
It has so much to say.
There's an actual relationship there. That's the thing. Like, there's an actual dynamic there that I think, you know, that's why. That's able to work, and that's why we're able to tolerate it on a level.
And this is the best ending of the movie. This is the best ending of the year. I think it's so strong, and that is the reason why this movie is the best movie of the year. Well, I think this movie would have been great. I don't think it would have been better than, you know, some of the movies that I put up in my top 10 list or top 5 list so far of the year. That last scene was unbelievable.
I know you love that last scene, but I would like to argue to let the other part of the ending, like the 10 minutes before that last scene, I'd like to include that in the ending as well. Because I think that first, the ending that we thought was going to be didn't end up the penultimate, right? Basically, what I'm saying is I think the ending could be separated into two parts, but I think the first part was so great as well that the second, which made the second half so worth it. So yeah, this is a fantastic movie, fantastic ending all around. I loved it.
Yeah, this is near perfect, I think. We gave it nines and 9.8s and 10. I think we all loved this movie. Go out and see it. It's in limited release.
Hell or High Water.
At River East, directed by David McKenzie.
It might also be at the Landmark.
It's expanding now. It's expanding this weekend to almost nationwide, I believe.
I've been recommending it to everybody that I know, so hopefully people go see it.
Formerly known as Comancheria, go see Hell or High Water.
Thanks, Reed. I appreciate that. So you want to get to recommendations?
Yes.
Reed.
I'm nodding my head. What do I recommend? I've been doing my part in just trying to see so many movies lately that I'm like blanking now. Let me. Why don't you go first? I have a list. I'm gonna pull up my list.
So 2 days ago, I kind of watched. I watched a lot of films. It started with Pete's Dragon, which I really liked, and then I saw Joshi. I saw the film with Thomas Middleditch, Nick Kroll, Adam Pally. It's like a mumblecore. It's one of those mumblecore films. Joshi.
Oh.
And I found it. You know. It was middling at best in terms of its, you know, in terms of its spot in that genre, the mumblecore genre.
Well, it's funny just to see like how it is starting to become more mainstream because 10 years ago you would have never gotten someone like Nick Kroll. Even, I mean, and they're not like huge celebrities, but even actors
but
like that.
Joe Schwamberg, this is like a Joe Schwamberg movie.
No, but he's in it. Oh, okay.
He's in the movie. He has a small cameo.
He's a better director than this. He wouldn't do this
movie. You didn't see it?
What?
Did you see it?
No, but I've just from the review, I think Joe Swanberg's a really talented guy, so I just feel like this movie is
this movie.
Well, he's also in Your Next, which he's great in.
I love Your Next.
Adam Wingard directed film.
But this movie doesn't get there entirely, but I thought there's a very divisive moment at the end, like a go for it moment, and I liked it.
Did you laugh a lot?
I enjoyed it. Not really.
No.
I think this movie just kind of falls short, and it kind of falls into the trap of like the mumblecore movies that are just kind of mediocre at the end of the day, and the ones that don't transcend, like the ones that are.
Yeah, and it's actually I haven't.
Who are the two brothers? The Duplass brothers.
Duplass brothers.
This movie does not get even close to the heights that those movies reach.
But it's almost funny because I mean I haven't actually seen any of their films. I've seen a lot of episodes of Togetherness, the Duplass brothers.
See their movies.
Yeah,
they're awesome.
Very good.
But I mean, it is funny how it's just like you get these filmmakers who, I mean, when someone innovates like a genre and they really have like created this whole, I mean, I think you can make arguments that there was things like mumblecore before it, but the way that they've kind of opened this up as a genre, like you get these imitators who just that's what separates the best from the imitators.
I just think this movie kind of stews and revels in its sadness, and I think they're taking away from those films the wrong wrong ideas.
Yeah.
Although there is a moment at the end, like I said, that is,
I can't comment. I have no idea what you're talking about.
There is a moment at the end that is very divisive and like it's surprising. It's kind of a twist.
Yeah.
It's on my DVD queue, so I'll
check
it out.
I thought it was effective, and I ended up liking the movie. I ended up liking it. Next film, what was the next film? Oh, The Fitz. The Fitz is an amazing, amazing film. You have not seen it, right?
Yeah, I know I know some sort of premise, but I know very little. All I know is the reviews have been fantastic, so it's on my most anticipated. I have it on my DVD queue as well.
It's directed by Anna Rose Homer. And this is a Sundance hit. This came out of Sundance.
She had been mentioned for Captain Marvel. She was in the running. I don't think she's going to get it.
Yeah, but
and this didn't get a release in Chicago, right?
No, it didn't.
It was supposed to, and it never came.
I saw all these on iTunes. I think iTunes is really, they do some, they get a lot of really cool films.
I think YouTube does this. They're very similar. You can pay like $2.99 for each, and you get pretty much every movie.
But The Fitz is about a young adolescent girl in a, I'm sorry, am I loud in the...
What?
Am I loud? Your headphones, you're taking...
No, I'm just... I'm trying to go in not knowing anything.
Oh, okay.
Sorry,
you don't want me to say it? I'm going to say it.
Go ahead, I'm not
listening. It's about a girl in a community center in a largely black community, and she is a boxer, and she boxes with her brother all the time, and then as she grows, she wants to, you know, become a dancer and be a part of the dance team, and it's just really almost a short film about her transition and about adolescence and about what that means, and then there's some really weird... crazy moments and kind of supernatural moments that take place, but I don't really want to spoil anything. Those aren't really integral to the plot. It's more just those are moments that are meant to convey the idea of the film, not actual. You're not supposed to wonder like, well, what's happening? You know, it's a much more heady movie than that. It's amazing, and the central performance from, I forget her name, Royalty Hightower, is she's unbelievable, and she's gonna get some more roles. She's incredible.
Well, and it's nice to see, like, especially, I mean, earlier when we were talking about that trailer, that movie, I don't even remember the name.
What trailer?
The what was the trailer?
Oh,
Are you talking about the
Unfortunate
Taraji?
Yeah.
Oh my God, Hidden Figures.
And this is like the type of like filmmakers we need, and this is like the type of movies we need coming out, and just things that are actually changed, like. Creating a conversation.
I want to say, though, that you haven't seen either of these movies, so I feel like
I think I can in terms of just, like, a cultural, like, conversation, and in terms of just, like, the marketplace, in terms of just, like, you have one movie that, and just from the trailer, like, it's obvious, like, it's still, like, these movies don't exist in a vacuum, and you can still comment on them, like, on that level. You're right that I can't comment as to, like, the specific quality of each films, but I think you can still, like, judge them on a face value in terms of just, like,
yeah, I know. I just,
the trends they're symbolizing.
You just never know what movie's going to jump and surprise you. That's the only thing I would know.
This movie just has the best score of the year, and it feels alive. It has like this, heartbeat to it, and it's awesome. It's only an hour and 12 minutes.
Which
also,
is good
and,
to me.
And to be fair, it's not like we do that all the time on the show. I mean, we talk about trailers all the time.
Oh, you're still hung up on that?
Yeah.
All right. And then I also watched...
Well, I mean, it's the truth, though.
I also watched Creature, which Daniel
and I have both seen.
Yeah, you guys seen. Yeah. I finally caught up.
We talked about it on the show before. I think we kind of mentioned
and
it
like
in our recommendations.
You guys mentioned it like 3 weeks
in a row.
We can
do a mini review.
It's awesome. That movie is really, really
another
good.
Very short film as well. Yeah. A24 did that. I recommend everyone watches Krisha because I think it's going to go down as a more forgotten film of 2016, but it's actually one of the best films.
Well, and it's nice that the director, Trey...
Edward Schultz.
His name is Trey in the movie, I think.
Trey right? Edward Schultz. Yeah, that's
his name. Trey Edward Schultz. It's nice that even though like this movie didn't seem to make as big as an impact as it could have, especially here in Chicago because it only got a 1 week release.
Yeah.
He's already been attached to another project. I think for me, like, it's really inspiring to see movies like this because I think it's something that, you know, young filmmakers should really look up and idolize, where it's just like this movie doesn't have, you know, you can tell like they don't have the nicest or fanciest cameras, and like the movie has this very, you know, rough around the edges feelings, but it uses that to its advantage, and I think it shows that
the camera spins a lot in this movie, which is interesting.
And I mean, you can tell, like,
it is a disorienting movie.
Yeah, and it's like almost like camcorder aesthetic, but that's what I love about films like this, is that if you really know what you're doing, it doesn't matter if you have, you know, a camcorder, if you have, you know, if you don't have the nicest equipment, like, it's all about the filmmaking, it's all about how you use these tools in a way to create a mood, a story, and like, I think in that sense, like, that's what's really inspiring about
in the middle part of Krisha, there was kind of just a long scene of nothing necessarily happening, but just watching the kitchen and watching the house kind of unfold and the characters in it, and I had just seen Knight of Cups, and I was like, this is a young Terrence Malick right here. Like, I'm just
watching. He worked on Terrence Malick films.
Yeah, he had. Really? And I didn't. Yeah. That's the funny thing.
That's actually really
so
funny.
So the funny thing is, you I found that out after I thought to myself, this kid's Terrence Malick-esque. And then it turns out that he worked with Terrence Malick.
Well, and I think it's
you
really.
You can see, like, legitimately, you can see kind of the impression that Terrence Malick had on him. By the way, Krisha is 1,000 times better than Knight of Cups. Knight of Cups is trash.
Knight of Cups is a good movie.
Sorry, Daniel.
It's way better.
This is way better.
Krisha's way better than. And also, like, just thinking about now, like, the shots I really remember is how he has, like, those insert shots of, like, the oven and microwave. And, like, the tension he gets out of those shots is just, like, man,
he's talented, this
is a good filmmaker, man.
Yeah.
And all the sweat dripping down.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the way she's dressed, the way he lights her.
Oh, yeah. Or just, like.
And her alone. You know, she's lit differently than everybody else.
And the way the background characters are just so subtly annoying, I think, is so brilliant and such an underrated part of this movie because they need to be just a little bit annoying for Krisha to go slower and slower into insanity.
And just really like the way, like, those montages, and, like, the movie is kind of like the series of just, like, montages one after another, but I think it's like the one in the middle of the movie where she's having that conversation with I think it's her brother-in-law.
Yeah. And I actually didn't totally know who he was.
He was, I think, the brother. He was married to her sister, I believe.
No, but
in the moment.
Or, you know, he might have been I think he was the stepdad.
Yeah, because I don't think.
Yeah, I think
it was weird, his relationship to
but
the family.
But he was great.
But I kind of like that the movie.
He was very charming.
Tell you.
Yeah, because it kind of just. I think in some ways it
makes
even.
Tell you any of the relationships except for her and her son.
And it disorientates you more, like, not knowing exactly.
Exactly,
like,
yeah, it's a little uneasy. Yeah.
And I love, like, the dynamics there. It's like, she's walking into a room. It's like, there's a lot of history here, but I don't know, are you the sister? Are you, like, how well do you know Krisha?
It never bothers to tell you, and you don't need it to, because that's how kind of she feels. She kind of just feels lost and with us.
And this movie is not surprising in the way that you know where it's going, but then it's so surprising that it just, like, goes there.
Oh,
and
no.
goes there and just falls deeper into this pit of despair and awkwardness, and just, like, it is so punishing, this movie.
And they're
to
shared
watch.
History, but it's also, like, the worst kind of shared history, because it's completely adversarial, and, like, these are people who just do not like each other, and just seeing the layers being peeled off. And just that middle montage where he's just, like, cutting back and forth from that conversation to see, like, you know, there's, like, these two stupid, like, cousins who just, like, fight shirtless all the time, and just, like,
I want to know the themes behind, like, why, like, how violent the kids are, and, like, why.
Well, that's
they're just, like, there's a lot of stuff to unpack that I just don't
know. And that's what's so great.
And that's what I kind of like about the movie, is that, and in some ways, like I think it's very, I mean, obviously Krisha has done these very, like, regrettable things, and I don't think the movie sugarcoats that, but at least for me, and maybe it's just because, like, the movie was also shot in Houston, and that's where I'm originally from, and I ran away from there.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really run away, but.
You did. It's okay.
But
you can talk about
it. I mean, seeing, you know, stuff in that stuff, it's just, like, I felt like I could really relate to her character, which is, like, I don't want to be here either, and, like, I feel like there's a lot of digs at, like, suburbia being thrown in that movie.
We need to move on to other recommendations.
My last recommendation is a comic, The Wicked and the Divine, which I've been reading for a little bit, but I didn't recommend it last week.
I saw you reading that.
Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey. It's an Image comic, and the premise is really cool. It's a Every 90 years, 12 gods incarnate young people on Earth. and they become pop stars, and they're like the Kanyes, the Lady Gagas of the world, and you know, people know that they are gods. They know that they're gods, and they worship them, and go into their concerts is like a religious experience. And then in 2 years they die, and then they come back in another 90 years, and it's just a commentary on the way we view celebrity, social media, everything pop culture. Well,
to me, honestly, it almost sounds like Satoshi Kon could make it into an incredible film.
Exactly. Dude, exactly. It feels like that. And it's so, so freaking
good. Actually, yeah, I might actually read that. That sounds
so freaking good. I'll lend it to you after I'm finished the first, the second issue. Man, it's awesome. And the art is just beautiful. The writing is so smart. Yeah.
Awesome.
So, actually, I finally caught up on the night of, and the
I should have talked about that because I'm caught up
You
as well.
Talked about enough, Matt.
Yeah, let me talk.
Jeez. I'm just joking, dude.
No, but I finally caught up on it, and it's a thing where, the thing that I'm actually going to recommend about the show is John Turturro, because I feel he's so good in this show, and it's just so fun to see, especially because lately, like, his career has been a little uneven in terms of just, like, a lot of the films he's been, like, he's done a lot of just these kind of junk blockbusters, but he's just so likable in this show, and just it's such a charismatic performance, and it's just fun to see. It's fun to see an actor that I kind of forgot about just being this great on TV again.
Yeah,
just,
it is.
And
really,
you know,
surprising.
It was supposed to be James Gandolfini in that role.
Yeah.
That,
oh, really?
That was his
role,
and then he passed away.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and he's just excellent. The way he just builds, like, he's just kind of like this scrawny kind of scumbag, but he's so relatable, and you have so much empathy for this guy, and you just really...
Even though he is a scumbag, which I like, they don't hold any punches. Like, no, pull him, like, he's a scumbag.
Well, he's kind of like... It's like a morally relative scumbag, where he's like... He's a scumbag, but like, he has some conscience like... And that's what I like about the
And
character.
He knows what he is.
No, yeah, he knows...
He knows he's a little creep at times. Like, he's shown himself to be creepy a little bit, but, you know, everyone's kind of creepy in this show.
Or he's a scumbag, but he kind of, like... He reserves who he like... steals from and who he doesn't, which is what I
what I'm gathering is you don't like the rest of the show.
It's not that I don't like it. I just don't. I think that I'm just not as on board with it as everyone else. There's a part of it that feels, and it's something that I haven't been able to quite articulate, because I do like watching it, and like I look forward to it, but I just always feel a little underwhelmed by it. And I think it's because, and I don't think it's a problem with Riz Ahmed, but I feel like that character is just such a cipher for me, and like, and it's not even that, like, his decision making. It's just I feel like, and I get why, but I feel like they've made him into such a blank slate that I never am, like, hooked by, like, his emotions. Like, I never really understand, like, where the character is coming from, other than it's just like, we want to, like, show you this side of prison culture, so we're gonna force this, like, plot on him. And
that's understandable.
And it's something that I feel like it's holding me back on the show, and it's a weird way where I feel like, and it's not. This show is on the good end of the spectrum, but it's definitely playing into, like, this stereotype of, like, cable, like, prestige TV shows where, like, it's just so grim and it's so, like, overproduced in a way that...
I think it's better than that.
No, it is. And it's definitely, like, I mean, I think on the worst end of the spectrum, you can have something like House of Cards, which is just a bad show and just, like, and completely, like, insincere about actually trying to dig deep at, like, the themes that it's going on. Like, this show does, but I feel like there's a weird way where I feel like... Like, I just think it's a little bit more muddled than I would like, and it's a thing where it's just, like, if I want something about, like, prisons, I think I prefer something like Orange is the New Black.
Or Prison Break.
Well,
or Prison
Break. This is a way different interpretation of prison than Orange is the New Black.
Well, I feel like Orange is the New Black...
This is more on the Oz spectrum.
No,
here's the thing about this show, and have no interest in watching Oz, but, like, the thing about The Night Of...
Why? Why do you have no
interest? I have no interest in prison shows anymore. I feel like I've seen it all, and I think this show
is
kind of...
Well, Oz is the...
That's fine, you know, that's, but I don't need... I know,
and I haven't seen Oz.
I don't have any interest in seeing it because I think I've seen pretty much all I can see in a prison show.
Well, you're wrong.
But maybe I'm wrong. Whatever. I still have no interest in seeing it. Maybe I watch it and I, you know, lose my mind. But
this can be y'all's argument of...
Which I do recommend The Night Of, but I loved the first two episodes because it was kind of showing the procedural effects of someone getting arrested and all that stuff. I thought that was really intriguing. And I think it kind of has gotten a little bit stuck in prison. However, the last couple episodes have started to move more towards the investigation, which I enjoy. So I recommend The Night
Of. Well, it's also... That's the least interesting part to me is the investigation. I don't really
care.
I don't really care who did it, and
I
don't think the show.
Yeah,
really,
me either.
I don't really think the show.
No, the show doesn't care at all.
Either.
Obviously,
I love this show, and I think that it really, where it shines is the minutia of it all and the little details that it decides to shine a light on. It's like all of the weird inconveniences and how much of a change this is for everybody around. Oh my God, Khan.
Yeah, the Khan family.
Yeah, what's his name?
Riz Ahmed.
No. The character
Nasir Khan. Yeah.
Everybody around Nasir is like how this affects their life. And the cab, like that cab detail, see, where his father can't get the cab back because it's locked up almost like seemingly forever, and he has to do other jobs. And the way his mother is kind of breaking down.
But don't
down
you feel like the show doesn't then give enough time to the family? Because that's I kind of feel disconnect with that, because I feel like it's you obviously sympathize with these people because I mean the constraints his family is being put in is just horrible. But I feel like. Like, there's a time, I guess, where I wish we got to know their family more than just, like, these people were just, like, victims. Because that's kind of how they feel to me right now, where they don't really feel like... And obviously, there's still a lot of episodes to go and more time to flesh it out.
But I think this is not a show about them. It's about the system inflicting its menace on people like that. And the moments that I like the show are when we see... how the system is completely screwing
that's
their
true.
Life up.
I think that's true. But
and it's from the perspective of
I just
the
wish
system.
The show could give me just a little bit more. Like, I feel like it can still do that, but just flesh these characters a little bit more out for me. And also, I think just to go back to my earlier point, like, and I feel like I just feel there's other things, like even something like Serial or How to Make a Murderer that kind of covers a lot of the same ground as this. And I think it's just,
Making a Murderer.
Oh, make, yeah. Making How to Make a Murder is the feel.
How to Train Your Dragon, I think you're thinking of.
Making a Murder, I think it's able to dig deeper than this show is, at least for me at this point. But it is a really engaging show, and I think it's totally, especially right now in terms of what's on TV, you should be watching the show.
Yeah.
And
it's really good.
Two other films that I saw this week. I told myself I was going to go see Multiple Maniacs on Wednesday because I haven't seen any John Waters films, and he's someone that I feel like I should know about. So beforehand, I saw his version of Hairspray, or the original Hairspray that was later turned into a musical and then into a movie. And, you know, it's funny because I saw Multiple Maniacs the next day, and Hairspray is already kind of like, it's a very campy film. It's a very loosely structured film. But compared to Multiple Maniacs, it's just like the most conventional film ever, because Multiple Maniacs is just purely like intentional camp trash. Like, there's literally a scene where... the main character, who's Divine, who was kind of like one of his, kind of like, especially his early films, was kind of like his leading actor in all of his films, he's a drag performer, goes into a church, and it has, well, I don't know if I can say this on radio, but something horrible happens in this church, sexually, and it's just, it's such trash, but it's so self-aware about it, and it's so skillful in terms of just like how much it's playing into that camp that I think if you're kind of a fan of any of that. Like, I was just laughing throughout Multiple Maniacs. And Hairspray was fun just to compare that to the musical, because the musical is obviously much more sanitized on some level, and it's the elements of camp are kind of reduced. And what I was surprised by it is that it's still... Hairspray's still really campy, but it's very honest about the social conditions of that generation, and it's still kind of, like, shocking, like, how... honest it is about those things. And it kind of, it surprisingly me in a good way took me off guard. Like, I didn't expect this movie to like confront racism, so even if it's super broadly, like so explicitly. So yeah, I mean, John Waters, like, he's definitely, you know, he's not for everyone, but I think if you're willing to just try something different that's more out there, that's more explicitly, I mean, really, like, in terms of underground and like camp filmmaking, he's kind of the godfather of it in a lot of ways. So yeah, definitely. They're definitely both worth checking out.
Awesome.
Yeah, so just a couple of recommendations. I finally watched Clouds of Sils Maria. Is it Olivier Osias film, which stars Kristen Stewart and Juliette Binoche. And I had never seen it. I heard great things, and it lived up to the hype. It's a very slow burn, and it's a very relationship-based film, which centers genuinely in conversations really only between two people in Kristen Stewart and Juliette Binoche, but you see their relationship to grow as Stewart plays the personal assistant to Binoche, who plays a famous actress, and she's dealing with a tragedy and just seeing how they practice for a film. It also has a lot of Entourage-like elements, but it's way more subtle and less douchey, and actually kind of seems, even though I'm not in the industry, it seems more accurate. So I definitely recommend that film. It's really good. And Kristen Stewart, for all the people that think she can't act, she can. She's really good.
I heard she's great in that
She's
film.
Really good in
Didn't
that
she
movie.
Did she win like an award?
She
at, like,
won awards, and a lot of people thought she should have won. She
got an Oscar nomination.
Some people thought she should have had an Oscar nomination, and she was really good. And Binoche is always amazing. And then the other film I watched on Netflix, formerly of Paramount Studios, but they got rid of it and they gave it over to Netflix, is The Little Prince, the animated film, starring with the voices of Jeff Bridges, Rachel McAdams, Paul Rudd, Marion Cotillard, and James Franco, who's really good, by the way. And this movie is fantastic. Like, I kind of loved it. Like, I was surprised by how much I really loved it. And I think it's genuinely, again, it's just a film that lets characters develop, and it lets this little girl form a bond with Jeff Bridges' old man character, and the storytelling aspects of it, it's just beautiful, and it's a big, bombastic, fairy tale like story, and it's fun.
Actually, like, a really nice, like, combination of, because and we see, like, that all the time in terms of just, like, with kids' films, where it's just, like, how can we repurpose this narrative to, like,
right,
make it more kid-friendly in terms of just, like, the whole device there is that she's this girl who's, like, living in this world that's, like, everyone's exactly the same.
All adults, you grow up at a certain point, all you do is work, and there's no fun.
Yeah, and basically imagination is discouraged.
Yeah.
And it kind of uses that as a framework for, like, the Little Prince stories.
And that was, like, my only kind of downside of the film, is that it really hammers you over the head with, you know, adults are bad and growing up. And it serves a purpose for the film.
No, yeah.
But after a while, it gets a bit repetitive, but there's the town that they live in, where her house is located. It's very reminiscent, I don't know if you guys remember, in The Incredibles, the town, the car that Bob Parr or Mr. Incredible gets into, the yeah. little cul-de-sac that they live in. The architecture looks very similar, and I got a lot of hints of, you know, the adult life as being a boring adult. So I think they took a lot of stuff from Incredibles.
Yeah, I mean, and the device is kind of repetitive, but they make it work much better than
and
many
the animation
films.
Is gorgeous, yeah. And it switches up. It's not just one singular type of animation. They have a lot of, seem like, I'm not good with animation, but like drawings, and then into like 3D and
no,
type
yeah.
of stuff. So
yeah, I mean, it's a gorgeous film.
It's a gorgeous film. So I check. It's on Netflix Instant, so I recommend that especially.
Anyone awesome. Who's babysitting, good movie yes. to show.
Is that it?
That is it.
All right.
We'll start doing box office again once this summer, because the summer's winding down and it's so unpredictable. So once we get into September, we'll start up with box office again on our same show, but no new circumstances.
This is it, guys.
Yeah. It's been crazy.
Yeah.
How many years? 3 years?
Yeah, three.
Right, you've
half,
been doing it
3.5 years.
I only got to do it for one, but I am incredibly grateful that yeah. you guys let me stay on. I don't know how.
I just want to say I'm so happy that you guys are in my life in this way, yeah. In this
Calm
capacity.
Down.
Thank you so much.
I'm leaving. I'm leaving your life the second I leave the studio.
Yeah, but I am truly lucky that I found you guys to be on the show, and I wouldn't.
And
have
that's
it any
not.
Other way.
And we should thank Mike and Bella too as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
And Rudy, if you're out
Rudy,
there
yeah,
listening.
Rudy. But Matt, thank you, and Daniel, both of you guys, and everybody. Thank you for having me on, and this has been like the best. I mean, it's been about a year now since I joined. I joined last September, and I had guested once or twice before, but yeah. like, you know, I was just a guy that was seeing a bunch of movies, and I don't think I knew that much, and I think I've learned so much more in this past year, and like, I was just kind of talking to myself about movies, and now I can talk to myself in here. I know you guys aren't listening, but at least I can talk in front
you know
of people,
that.
And you're trapped in
well,
a room.
Well, that's how,
you're
we, all,
trapped
that's
in
how
a room.
We all feel like.
Yeah, yeah, you're trapped in a room, and you have to sit by me while I talk movies, and I am truly grateful for it.
Yeah,
so,
I honestly can't remember, aside from Rudy, I can't imagine the show without you, Reed.
Oh my God! So thank you so much.
Yeah, we're gonna be back in some capacity. Hopefully, still on iTunes.
We'll still be on iTunes.
But we have to like try to shed the Radio DePaul name
yeah.
and like
we might have a name change.
Yeah, yeah, we're called Podcast yeah. DePaul now. We're gonna be something different.
Yeah, we're gonna be something different. And we're still gonna be doing this for as long as we can, and because
we're just going to take the O
it
out
is,
of pop.
Yeah, this is the best part of my week, and I'm going to miss this.
And I'm going to
yeah.
start. I'm genuinely, and I think all of us will contribute. We're going to start posting some video reviews. I'm going to do some written stuff, and I know I keep saying that, but it's true. I mean, I officially graduated with school, so I, you know, I got to get a job.
Yeah,
and,
I have my
know,
blog,
so.
Film Scribes, that I haven't updated. I over
and I'd like
months.
To do some reviews on that if you're willing to allow.
Oh yeah,
me
definitely.
To,
if you guys yeah. want to use that, we can use that as.
So yeah, we're not going anywhere. We're just yeah. kind of leaving the building.
No, well, yeah, and this has been so much fun for me, and not to toot our own horn, but something that I really do appreciate about what we've been able to do here is that I think we all actually bring something different to the podcast in terms of just like. The types of films we like, and I think that
I bring stupidity. You guys bring intelligence, and Matt brings charm. And then, you know, we're a great team together. And Mike, Mike brings grace. Mike brings grace.
Gravitas.
Bella brings respect. Like, yeah. we're all of us together. We have a nice little team here.
Yeah.
Well, that's the end. You're listening to Radio DePaul Chicago's College Connection. This is Popcast Season 5, Episode 7. And thank you for spending...
Season 4, isn't it?
No, Season 5.
Season 4.
It's Season 5.
How? How is it Season 5?
You're messing with
me. We're still getting this wrong now.
It's season four this year, and then the summer was season five.
Are you sure?
Yeah,
no, we were season three last year.
Yeah.
No, this is season four right now.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to tell
you. Next week will be season five.
That's what I was trying to tell you. This is season four. We've been saying four all summer.
I'm glad that our final conversation is still.
This is good. No, I'll give you a chance.
This is so fitting.
Yeah.
But I just wanted it to be accurate. It's season four.
Yeah, season four, episode 7.
Yes.
That's what I said.
No, you didn't. But okay.
Thank you for spending all this time with us here on Radio DePaul. We appreciate Radio DePaul, Chicago's College Connection. This is my last time.
I want to say thank you to Scott Viverman, by the way, general manager here at Radio DePaul, for giving us the opportunity.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone at Radio DePaul.
Yeah. Joe Lanzarotti, who hired me on this show.
Even like, I mean, I feel like I've always kind of been an outsider here because I literally just got this show because I just talked to Matt about movies. I kind of lucked my way into here. But I mean, in terms of just people I've met here, like, I mean, Derek Peters, like, always gracious, always great.
Yeah, he's not that great. No.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I'm going to cut that out.
Okay. No. I'll edit that out.
No, don't. He listens to the show, so I want him to hear that.
Okay.
Yeah. Edit out when I said he listens to the show, so he just...
Anyone listening, I still am going to be at Radio DePaul Sports for the upcoming year with Adam Shalif. We'll keep running with the Bulls going. I got that show coming up right now, actually, so we'll get a full year of that. We're not going anywhere. We still got Popcast, just with a different name.
Yeah.
So we're going to come back, and we're going to be even better than ever.
For the last time, this time... You're listening to Radio DePaul Chicago's College Connection. This has been Popcast Season 4, Episode 7. Have a good day. Have a good life. And we'll see you elsewhere. Happy Friday, everyone. You're listening to Radio DePaul Chicago's College Connection. This is Popcast Season 5, Episode 6.
Seven,
am I right?
Seven?
Is it seven?
Yeah, I think it's seven.
Well, welcome to Popcast, the show.
I think it's nine,
review.
Actually.
Reed, let me do this. This is my last time
doing this.
I think
it's 12. Go ahead. I'll let you do this with silence.
Yes. This is Popcast, the show. Where we review, discuss, and gush over all things pop culture, more specifically movies and television.
What episode is it?
Oh my God!
We're going to start over. What episode is this? We got to get it right. Daniel, what episode is it?
It is seven. Oops.
Last night was awesome.
Yeah, why don't you explain what we did last
night? Well, last night, our long-lost co-host, Mike Constantino, who hasn't been on the show
he
for
lives.
A while.
He lives, everybody.
He shot us a text on the group chat, the podcast group chat, a little behind-the-scenes stuff. And he said, hey, I'm a manager at Second City, Chicago. Why don't you come by and check out, you know, some of our improv shows and this new show that we have called Unelectable You. It's a commentary on this present...
presidential election.
No, I said the present presidential election.
Correct.
That's what I was saying.
That is correct. You are correct. I had to make sure Matt was correct.
Hillary Rodham Clinton and Donald J. Trump. And it was,
what's the J stand for?
It was a lot of
Jabroni.
It was a lot of fun, and we laughed our asses off.
Yeah, yeah, it was awesome. Really funny.
And then we went to another improv show down in the basement.
Yeah, we had VIP access. Yeah, we had VIP access because of Mike.
I felt really important.
I did too.
And we went, and that was even better than the first one. And it was just a tease because we only got to see 5 minutes. But it got me thinking about Don't Think Twice, guys, and how bad the improv was in that movie.
I think they purposely were supposed to be not that great at improv.
Really?
I do, because there's no way a funny guy like Mike Birbiglia.
I think I think that there's some truth in what you're saying, in the sense that I think they're obviously not supposed to be like the funniest comedians in the world. They're not supposed to be, you know, Chris Rock or like George Carlin up there, but it still should have been funnier.
Neither of those guys did improv, right?
Well, no, yeah, but I'm
sure they did improv at
some point. I mean, Tina Fey or like Bob Odenkirk.
Sure.
Or Steve Carell.
Or Paul Tompkins. You know, the Titans.
Or Colbert.
Colbert, sure.
We could just keep naming a million people.
But I still think there's truth in terms of like the scenes outside of the improv stuff should have been funnier too.
Yeah, I think that movie suffered from a lack of hilarity.
Yeah.
You know, the best...
Ironically enough.
The best improv that I've seen ever on television or in film was the episode of The Office with Michael Scott shooting everybody.
Shooting, takes out the gun.
Bang, bang, bang. You're dead.
Okay, so you know what? That's very funny because I took an acting class my first year in college, and there was an improv group that came in and we were like recruiting kids, so we had to do like these improv things.
Uh-huh.
And people did leave it to everybody to pull out a gun when they didn't know what they were going to do next.
Did they do it because of The Office, or they did it?
Because it's the go-to like surprise, quote-unquote, funny thing.
Get on your knees.
Yeah, but it's like
dirtbag.
Yeah, but it's like, I had a gun the whole time. It's like, it's so dumb, and it's so, it's just like, that made me appreciate improv a lot more when I did it even after 3 people had done it, because I was like, you know, people are doing that. It seems to be working.
Well, had you seen The Office?
No, I hadn't.
No, you hadn't. Okay.
I don't think anybody did.
So once you saw that episode of The Office, you probably lost it.
No,
I would have. Like,
I was embarrassed. I
you should be.
Yeah.
You're a train wreck for that. Yeah. But, you know,
it was
apparently a lot of people do it.
Yeah, a lot of people do it. It's a crutch. It's a crutch, the gun in improv. But last night's improv, those guys were professionals and a half, and I think they were awesome.
Yeah, we went one of the... I think there are a few stages with like when it comes to like the talent that people see, and I think there's the main stage where it's like the closest people the people that are closest to going to onto the next stage of like possibly Saturday Night Live or getting some film work. And then the stage we saw was like number two, kind of in the middle, where a lot of those people are still, you know, doing Mad TV. A couple of those people are
Mad TV is canceled.
Yeah.
Yes, but like, you know, they're doing things.
No, they're still doing it.
They're doing things, and it's great, and they were hilarious. And then after that main show that we sat through for like 2 hours, which was fantastic.
You said sat through, like we had,
no,
like it was
we
awful.
Suffered through.
We sorry.
Why, Mike? Why?
Yeah, it was tough. No, it was a breeze. I mean, it was amazing. And then afterwards, we went to the younger people group where they look like people around our age, and I didn't expect them to be as funny because they're younger.
They
and
were amazing.
They were just as. I mean, they were incredible.
Yeah.
So I got to go back to see a full.
I really do want to go
see
back.
Their full show,
because it was legitimately flooring how good they were and how I laughed a lot. That was really a lot of fun. Thank you, Mike. And that was our night. So you want to formally restart the show now?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
All right.